The Path by Maharaj Charan Singh, published by Radha Swami Satsang Vyas. Print copyright 1969-2002 and audio recording copyright 2021. Radha Swami Satsang Vyas. All rights reserved. Sugar, honey and buffalo's milk are all sweet, but incomparable, Fareed, is the sweetness of the Lord. Contents. Preface. Chapter 1. The Nature of This World. Chapter 2. The Search for the Lord. Chapter 3. Within the Temple of the Body. Chapter 4. The Living Master. Chapter 5. Devotion to the Word.
Preface. This book delineates the path, the ancient wisdom that has come to mankind ever since the world was made and which remains its sole hope of release and salvation. It is this path that all messengers of God come to reveal or uncover in all ages, climes and countries. It is natural and inherent within us. It was not designed by any human being. It is the design of the Creator and none can alter, amend or add to it. It is as ancient as man. The Creator, when He created human beings, designed this path in us. It is our exclusive patrimony and heritage, a pearl of great wisdom, the divine melody, the voice of God, the audible life stream, the holy coast, the word, the logos, the name, the kun, the sarosha, the music of the spheres lies hidden in the human body and reverberates at the third eye focus.
It is to this point that the body consciousness has to be retraced, retained and put in the orbit of the ever-resounding, immanent power through the help of a knowing master.
Then alone shall darkness give way to light, ignorance to knowledge, and transience to immortality. Three principles epitomize the philosophy behind the timeless path. First, the word or sound current without which there can be no escape from this veil of tragedy and tears, nor release from the cycle of birth and rebirth. Second, a living master, without whom the secret of the word cannot be obtained. And third, divine grace, without which the master cannot be contacted. Such in essence is the path that the messengers of God unfold. Only when we manifest the Lord within ourselves can we see Him everywhere, in every leaf, in every grain, in every particle of sand, and realize that nothing can happen without Him. The entire creation and its motivation are His dispensation. He is the doer behind all scenes. He is the player behind all games. He is the one who pulls the strings of the puppets behind all puppet shows.
Chapter 1. The Nature of This World. The One Message of Saints. Saints have come to the world in every age. Whatever their country or religion may have been, their message has always been one and the same: to know God and to seek release from the cycle of births and deaths. Their teachings were never meant to found religions, creeds and sects. Creeds and sects breed passions which invariably lead to quarrels and conflicts, while the essence of the teachings of all saints is love and harmony among the people of the world. While a saint is alive, we listen to his words, but we do not heed them. As soon as he leaves the world, we turn to rites and rituals and thus completely forget his teachings. We begin once again to reduce his lofty teachings and the truth of his experience into creeds and sects, thereby sowing the seeds of discord and dissension. We do this actually for selfish reasons and justify it in the name of national honor or the prestige of traditional religion. What greater injustice could we do to these great saviors than to misinterpret and narrow down their teachings and freeze them into creeds and sects that are based upon partial or incorrect versions of their teachings? If we were to search for and study carefully the purely spiritual content of their messages with an unbiased mind, we would find that all such masters bring the same message from the home of the Lord. All saints tell us that nothing that we see in this world has come into being of itself. There must be some creator. This creator is the one Lord, the one God of us all. We remember him with love and devotion by thousands of names. He is the supreme object of our search and our spiritual yearning. Our soul is of the essence of the Lord. We are a drop of that vast ocean of divinity, a ray of that mighty sun. As Tulsi Sahib says, the Lord dwells in the fourth realm. The soul is a particle of that all-knowing one. Kabir Sahib also says, O Kabir, the soul is a particle of God. Though it is in the body, it is never destroyed. Similarly, Goswami Tulsidas says, the soul is imperishable, being a particle of God, of that absolute truth, consciousness and bliss. Guru Nanak says, the soul is in God and God is in the soul. To illustrate how this is possible, take the example of a banyan tree. How spacious and sprawling is this tree, but how very small is its seed. If somebody were to tell us that there lies latent in this tiny seed a mighty tree, we might not easily believe it. But when we plant the seed and nurture it, the small sapling that sprouts from the seed grows in the course of time into a mighty tree. Only then do we realize that this little seed had the huge tree within itself, and that the tree has in it that tiny seed and many others like it. Thus Guru Nanak tells us, that when we carry out research within ourselves in accordance with the teachings of the saints, we will discover that the soul is within the Lord and the Lord is within the soul. The law of karma.
However, we feel that we are separate from God.
We find ourselves entangled in a tight web of illusion. This is due to the fact that when the soul came down from God, it took the mind as its companion. The mind is the slave of the senses. It runs after the sense pleasures and worldly objects. Whatever the mind does, the soul has to suffer the consequences because the soul and the mind are knotted together. Sages and seers have called this world a field of actions. Muhammad Sahib has called it the field where you sow for the future. This world is a field cultivated for the hereafter. Goswami Tulsidas says in his Ramayana that the law of karma reigns supreme in the world. That whatever one does, one must eat its fruits. In the New Testament it is said, whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Similarly, Guru Nanak says, do not blame anybody. Our own deeds are responsible for whatever happens. As I did, so do I fare. Why then blame others for it? Guru Arjan calls the world a field of karma. Christ refers to the law of this world in similar terms. Of thorns men do not gather figs, nor of a bramble bush gather they grapes. This world is a vast field of actions and reactions. Cause and effect are truly its warp and weft. Whatever deeds we do in this world, good or bad, we must bear their consequences. If we sow pepper seeds, we shall harvest peppers. We can never harvest apples. Nor can we sow thistles and expect to gather roses. When we sow mangoes, we can enjoy the fruit of mangoes. Whether we perform good deeds or bad ones, we have to tread the eternal wheel of births and deaths in order to reap their fruit. Good deeds may make us kings and rulers. They may give us sway over vast dominions. They may promote us from C-class to A-class prisoners in the vast prison house of this world. They may raise us from huts to palaces. They may free us from the iron fetters and replace them with gold ones. They may even entitle us to go to heavens and paradises, but they also are within the cycle of death and rebirth. So after exhausting our good karma, we must return again to the physical or the material world. On the other hand, if we do bad deeds, we must of course go to the regions called hell, and the cycle of death and rebirth is ever ready to imprison us again. Swamiji says, whatever actions you do, you must suffer their consequences. Sahaja Bai says, worm or insect, god, imp or devil, beast or bird or man, or any of the vast and varied forms that have their home in the sea, all these are born because of karma, all these of countless forms and hues. Pain and suffering. Rich or poor, king or beggar, woman or man, all are reaping the fruits of their karmas. Wherever the place of one's birth may be, one goes through a long chain of suffering and misery, pain and difficulties. Separated from the Lord, one has no peace or respite anywhere. Study any species of living being and you will find that it never has any peace. Every day we butcher birds and animals in hundreds and thousands. We have no compunction at all about cutting off their heads with knives. What peace can there be in the life of a hen, a sheep, or a goat? We forget how we would feel if we were to be reborn as an animal because of our karmas, and how we would feel if our necks were to be cut through by knives. When a doctor prepares a hypodermic needle to give us an injection, our whole body begins to tremble in spite of the fact that the injection is for our good. Think of the life of a camel, which is laden with a heavy load and is pulled along in a caravan by a nose string. Consider the case of a horse. We see how day after day it is harnessed to a carriage with a large number of passengers in it, and how mercilessly it is whipped to keep up a rapid pace. The same is the case with a bullock. All day long it pulls a plow in a field. If it is overcome by exhaustion and falls down, the farmer does not hesitate to use an iron goad to make it get up again. In the same way, you may study the case of every kind of living being and you will find that all are afflicted with troubles, suffering and difficulties. This is true even of man, who is called the top of creation. Human beings are made in the image of the Lord Himself. Sages and seers have regarded humans as being designed by God, in whom God Himself resides. Muslim fakirs have considered humans superior to the entire creation. But even in human life, there is little peace. Some are unhappy because of disease, others because of unemployment. Some have no children and yearn for them day and night, while others have a large number of children and can hardly provide for them. Some have to go to court to recover money they have loaned, while others are in debt and live in such fear of their creditors that they do not even sleep at night. Every day we see the sorry spectacle of beggars in great misery, stretching out their hands for alms and exposed to the inclemencies of all sorts of weather. They cry out the whole day, voicing their pain and suffering and their utter penury. Just visit a hospital and you will hear the cries of patients who are in agony. Similarly, if we were to visit a jail, you would hear pathetic tales of distress from the prisoners. Wherever you turn in this world, you will find pain and suffering. Just turn on a radio at any time of the day and you are likely to hear news of one religion fighting against another, or of one country attacking another. Differences of caste, creed and color all give rise to conflicts and arguments. The result is fighting and wars which have millions of men, women and children dead, widowed or orphaned. Such is the world that lies before our eyes. We are kept on the run all the time to earn our livelihood, in constant fear of death. We do not even know when or how it may come. Seeing the unhappy condition of the world, Guru Nanak cried out, "This whole world is afflicted with pain and suffering." Goswami Tulsidas says, "Every being in the creation is in pain and distress." How can we find peace and contentment in this world? If we cannot heave a sigh of relief when in human form, how can we do so in the form of any other species? The saints and masters tell us that nobody can ever have lasting peace and contentment in this vale of tears, where there is no pleasure unmixed with pain. It is a place of good deeds and bad deeds, and we suffer pain or enjoy pleasure according to the nature of our deeds. If you were to study closely the life of any human being, you would not come across a single person who has all pleasure and no pain. Or would you meet anyone who has all pain and no pleasure? We find that if we have 10 days of pleasure, pain follows close behind. If we spend 10 days in pain, we soon have a breathing space that contains some pleasure. All our pains are due to our bad karmas in past lives, the consequences of which we are bearing now. And whatever moments we have of pleasure are due to our good karmas. It is the combination of good and the bad karmas that shapes our destiny and gives us the human form, through which we settle our account of both good and bad deeds. If we had only good deeds to our account, we would be in one of the heavens. On the other hand, if we had only bad deeds to our account, we would be in one of the hells. Some people have done more good deeds than bad ones. For this reason, we see them apparently more happy than others. Others have done more bad deeds than good ones, and therefore they are more unhappy than others. It is for this reason that there are in this world so many pairs of opposites: riches and poverty, health and illness, high position and low, glory and dishonor. Everyone has his own individual karmas, the account of which he or she is settling in this world. This world has never been a paradise, nor can it be one in the future. When we study the history of the world, we find that it has never been free of discord and dissension, wealth and poverty, misery and happiness. This is true even though the world has been blessed all through the ages by the presence of sages, saints and social reformers. Saints tell us that the world has not improved, nor can it ever improve. The mission of the saints is not to make this world into a heaven on earth, but to offer us a way of putting an end to the cycle of births and deaths, so that we can leave this world once and for all. If we try to remove the thorns of the world, we can never succeed. But if we put on strong shoes, the thorns are completely ineffective. The problems of this world will always be insurmountable. No one has ever solved them for all time to come, nor will anybody do so in the future. By following the teachings of the masters, however, we can rise above the spheres of matter and mind, so that pleasure and pain do not affect us. Christ says in the Bible, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law." This means, I have not come to turn this world into a place of bliss and happiness, but I have come to release human beings from the prison of this world. I have come to break the chains of attachments to father, mother, son, daughter, friends and relations, in order to take people out of this cycle of repeated births and deaths. There is certainly no scarcity of philanthropists and social reformers. Many noble souls and kind-hearted people have been born time and again in this world and have tried their very best to give relief to suffering humanity. The benevolence of the saints, however, is unique, for no one else can do what they do for us. This is well illustrated by a small story. In a jail, there is a large number of prisoners. A kind-hearted philanthropist goes to the prison and pays for the supply of cold water to the prisoners every day during the hot summer. He has certainly done a very good thing for the prisoners, because he has given them something refreshing to drink instead of the warm water they were getting before. Another noble and kind-hearted philanthropist then goes to the prison and, finding that the prisoners are getting very poor food, provides them with delicious meals that prisoners enjoy very much. He has also done a very good thing for the prisoners. Then a third kind-hearted philanthropist goes to the prison and, seeing that during the freezing cold winter, the prisoners have no warm clothing, he spends a large sum of money and provides them with woolen clothes. He has also done a great good deed, possibly excelling that of the other two charitable men. Taking pity on the prisoners, all these benefactors have done their best to improve their lot. From C-class prisoners, they have become A-class prisoners, and their life in the jail has been made much more comfortable and far less insufferable. But in spite of all this, the prisoners are still prisoners and have to remain in the jail. Then a fourth kind-hearted man goes to the prison. He has the key of the prison and he opens its gates and sets the prisoners free forever. The kindness and generosity of the fourth man is of the greatest value. Saints come into this world with the key of this vast prison, and by inspiring us with love for the Lord and telling us the way to our real home, they release us for all time to come from the labyrinthine dungeon. Therefore, the value of the help given by such saints is far higher and far greater than that of any charitable person, social reformer or political leader.
So long as the soul does not go back and merge in its source, we can never escape from the prison of the body or the suffering and misery of this world.
Kabir Sahib says, "O bird of heaven, let us fly away from this land to Satlok, the land where truth abides. Leave this world of misery behind." Swamiji says, "Come, my friend, to your true home. Why live in an alien land?" The soul and the Lord. Guru Amar Das says, only the soul that is united with its true husband enjoys the bliss of eternal wedlock. Our soul is likened to a wife, and the Lord is likened to our husband. The soul can gain true bliss only when it reaches the feet of the Lord and thus becomes truly happy as a loving wife is with her husband. Guru Amar Das also says, only they are happy who have reached their true home. Such souls attain eternal bliss. In the Katha Upanishad, the Lord of Death gives a similar reply to Nachiketa. Jalaluddin Rumi, who is referred to respectfully as Maulana Rum, the learned one from Rum, also says, this world is a vast prison and we are all prisoners in it. Make a hole and escape. Many saints have likened the relationship of the soul and the Lord to that of a wife and a husband. For the wife can get true happiness and peace only when she is with her husband. If she is away from her husband, no matter what you may give her, honor, glory or riches, she can never get happiness or peace of mind.
Guru Arjan says,
if the wife meets not her husband, her beloved, how will she find peace? The house in which the husband has not appeared, cursed is that whole town, and her adornments, and her sweet-scented mouth, her pleasures and even her beauty and form, none of them is of any use. Those who belong to the Ramakrishna mission liken the relationship of the soul and the Lord to that of a mother and her son. As long as the child surrenders himself to his mother, he has no anxiety, no fear. He knows of no greater pleasure than to be in the lap of his mother. Jesus Christ likens the relationship of the soul with the Lord to that of a son with his father. As long as a child has his father to look after him, he has no worry or anxiety of any kind. All this in short means that the soul can gain bliss only when it meets the Lord. The state of the world. Sahajobai, a great woman saint, says, the rich are unhappy, the poor are the very picture of misery. The saint alone, who Sahajo, enjoys true happiness, to him is revealed a wondrous mystery. Similarly, Kabir Sahib says that kings and their subjects, the rich and the poor, are all unhappy and discontented. Of all who live in this house of clay, not one is happy, all live in suffering. Unhappy is the yogi, unhappy the mendicant who wanders from place to place, and doubly unhappy the ascetic. No place is empty of desires and hope of their fulfillment. The wheel of fortune turns and up and down they go, the householder and the anchorite alike. Fearing this pain, Sukhdev the great sage did from the womb relinquish all desires and turned his back on Maya. But when I speak the truth, no one believes, and lies I cannot tell. Even the gods are unhappy.
Brahma, Shiva and Vishnu, who set the pageant of the creation in motion.
Unhappy the hermit, unhappy the king, unhappy beyond words the pauper. Says Kabir, the whole world is unhappy. The saints alone, having subdued their mind, are truly happy. Tulsi Sahib likewise describes the unhappy state of the world. A tortured mind, a suffering body, such is the lot of some, and there be others on whom melancholy has set its potent seal. One sorrow or the other does ever prey upon mankind. Happy alone is the devotee of the saint. The Adi Granth says, in pain, O Nanak, are all created beings, and happy alone are they who are dyed in Naam. The entire creation is heavy-hearted and in trouble. Its cup of misery is ever full to the brim. Peace and bliss are only for those who are wedded to the Lord and depend entirely upon His support. We worldly people forget the Lord completely and do not search for Him within. We try to discover happiness and peace in beautiful scenes and worldly objects, but our own experience tells us that the more we seek happiness and forget the Lord, the deeper we plunge into pain and suffering. The things of beauty in which we seek happiness and contentment are short-lived, fleeting and transient. Therefore, happiness derived from them must also be short-lived. Until we find something that is eternal and everlasting and make it our own, there can be no question whatsoever of true and lasting happiness and contentment. For a certain length of time, the possession of some worldly objects may bring us joy, but its loss may make us very unhappy. If we look carefully at the world, we will find that what we call joy may very soon be turned into sorrow. For example, when a person gets married, he is supremely happy. But if his life partner turns out to be quarrelsome, overbearing, and unaccommodating, his life becomes very miserable. In the same way, when a child is born, the parents celebrate the occasion with great rejoicing. But if the child turns out to be disobedient or wicked or is called away by the Lord, one can well imagine the intensity of the distress and agony suffered by the parents. We search for happiness in wealth and toil day and night to amass it. We may sacrifice valuable principles. We may ruin our health and become mentally ill. We may suffer many ordeals and hardships. But if we do become wealthy, do we find any peace in safeguarding our wealth? If we keep it in the house, we are in constant fear of losing it by theft or fire. If we keep it in a bank, there is the fear that the bank may become insolvent.
We are tormented by thoughts about income tax, sales tax, and so on.
If our friends borrow money from us, we worry about it not being repaid to us. Or our wealth may be eaten up by doctors' bills or lawsuits. If our wealth is lost, the loss leaves behind it broken hearts and great distress. Wealth is earned with much pain and trouble,
but it still fails to bring the much desired happiness, and the misery caused by its loss may be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Guru Nanak says, "It is gathered not without sins, but it does not go with us at the time of death." We may think perhaps that happiness lies in the enjoyment of life. We therefore try to enjoy to the full the pleasures of the senses. We may take to indulging the palate and drinking, but these may make us sick or mental wrecks. We may turn our attention to power and authority in our attempt to find peace and pleasure. We may become political leaders. When people organize processions in our honor and praise us to the skies in public and in the press, our joy knows no bounds. But we read in the papers every day what happens to such people. Overnight, governments are overthrown, the opposition parties come to power and shoot or hang their rivals, or throw them into jail or slander them in the press. Then power and esteem end not in peace and happiness, but in misery and suffering. Kabir Sahab says, "When you ask for happiness, pain steps forward." It is apparent, therefore, that we cannot enjoy real peace and lasting happiness in this world. Whatever appears to be some sort of pleasure at one time is transformed after a while into pain. The true masters tell us, speaking from their own experience, that until our soul merges into its source, the supreme soul, Paramatma or God, there is no hope of our ever enjoying true peace and bliss. We can obtain happiness from wealth and possessions and from people and objects in this world only when we are devoted to the Lord. Then we are like a child who goes to a fair holding the hand of his father. He is delighted to see everything there. He sees the dazzling lights, the merry-go-rounds, the beautifully painted toys in the shops that sell candy and cakes. He imagines that the joy he experiences comes from the many things he sees at the fair. But he realizes his mistake when his hand slips out of his father's hand and he gets lost in the jostling crowd. Then he weeps and cries even though all the fascinating things at the fair are still there. He discovers that he could enjoy the fair only while he was holding his father's hand. In the same way, we enjoy peace and happiness in the world only as long as we constantly remember the Lord and are devoted to Him. That is why all saints inspire us with love for the Lord. Guru Amar Das says, "Priceless is devotion to the Lord, ineffable its glory." All of us in the world are in love with one thing or another. Some are attached to family and children, some to caste, creed and color, while still others love money. These shadowy, short-lived possessions are not worthy of our love because our attachment to them pulls us back to the cycle of death and rebirth. It is only intense love for the Lord and true devotion to Him that leads us to our union with Him. None is poor or bhikha. Everyone has rubies in his bundle, but how to open the knot, he does not know and thus remains a pauper.
Chapter 2. The Search for the Lord. There is only one Lord. It is the experience of all saints that the Lord is one. He is the common heritage of Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians and others. He is the one and the same Lord for all. Guru Arjan says, "One is the Father and we are all children of the One." Guru Nanak says, "He is the one bestower for all creatures. May I never forget Him." Sheikh Sadi says, All men are born of the same one essence and are brothers to one another. Whatever we see around us in the world is created by the one and only God. Muslims call him Rabbul Alameen, meaning the Lord of the entire universe. He is eternal and everlasting. He was in existence before this world was created. He is in existence now and he will be in existence hereafter. There is no question of one God before and another God later on. Guru Amar Das says, "The one who gives life to the entire universe, the one bestower for all." The one who is giving life to the entire universe is the one God of all. He is true or immortal. He is birthless and deathless. Right at the beginning of Japji Sahib, Guru Nanak has given a description of this one Lord. Primordial truth through eons truth, true now and true he shall ever be. As a result of my experience, Guru Nanak says, I have discovered within me a power that is unique and eternal, that never lessens and never ceases, that was, is and always will be. This power is God, whom devotees in their love call by thousands of names. Whatever we see apart from him is subject to change, decay and death. Change is inherent in everything. There is nothing that is lasting. Guru Nanak says, changeless is the Lord, changeless the Guru, and changeless the truth gained through contemplation. Elsewhere he writes, false is the ruler, false his subjects, false is all the world beside, false is the palace, false the towers, and false all those who live there. Gold is false, and silver false, and false the one they adorn. The body is false, false its clothes, and false their mirrored forms. False is the husband, false the wife, both are burned to ashes. The false are in love with the false and have forgotten their creator. Whom to love and make one's friend when the whole world is passing on? Even this body of ours is transient, and every object of this world we wish to own while in this body is also ephemeral. So, nothing in this world is worth our friendship and love except the one Lord. He alone is permanent. Castes and creeds. The Lord has no creed, religion or country. He has no caste or color. Guru Arjan describes the Lord as follows. No form, no caste or color has he. From his will the whole creation springs. The Lord who created the world is neither white nor black, nor has he any caste or creed. Our soul is of the essence of the Lord. It has come out of the Lord and longs to merge back into him. How can it have any caste, creed or color? If you study the teachings of any master, you will find that they all teach us to rise above differences of caste, creed and country. They all create in us love for the Lord. When the sun has no caste or creed, how can its rays have any? When the ocean has no caste or creed, how can its waves have any? When fire has no caste or creed, how can its flames have any? God created man. He did not create any sects or creeds. It is we who divide ourselves into narrow circles of caste, religion and country, and thus sow the seeds of strife, discord and dissension. Guru Amar Das says, where one has to account for one's deeds, neither body nor caste will go. Where the final settling of our account has to take place, no one will ask to which caste or creed we belonged. Even our body will not reach that place. It'll be consigned either to fire or to earth. All our castes and creeds will remain behind with the body. Kabir Sahib says very clearly, no one will ask your caste or creed. Whoever contemplates on him becomes his. No one will be interested in your caste or creed in the court of the Lord. It is only worship of him that matters and that enables us to merge into him. At the place where your accounts are to be settled, nobody will ask whether you are a Hindu, a Sikh or a Muslim, or whether you come from India, America or Africa. It is only your love, your devotion, your intense longing that matter. Bulleh Shah, a Muslim saint, says, your deeds alone will be taken into account, caste and creed will stand apart uncared for. Only those who watch their actions carefully are acceptable to him. Those who take pride in their caste and religion cannot approach or enter his court. Tulsi Sahib says, the low caste in their meekness have swum across by taking refuge in the feet of the saints. Many of noble birth have drowned through pride in their high caste. One who is meek and humble, who regards himself as the lowest of the low and who has love for the saints, can easily swim across the ocean of this world. Tulsi Sahib says, those who are egotistic and proud of their high caste are invariably drowned. Caste after caste, nation after nation and country after country have vanished because of their arrogance. Tulsi Sahib further says, when success overcomes a man, it infuses each tiny pore of his body with the poison of vainglory. He who has not met a true master is an outcast, whichever of the four castes he may belong to. When men rise to high positions, their first taste of honor and fame fills them through and through with pride. Yet the reality is that they belong to the lowest of the castes until they meet a saint and offer him their love and devotion. Paltu Sahib says, let no one, O Paltu, take pride in his high caste, for love alone counts in the court of the Lord. It is only one pointed and steadfast love for the Lord that enables us to realize him. Let no one think that because a person is born in a high caste, he alone has the privilege of meeting the Lord, or because he has changed his religion from Hinduism to Christianity, he alone is entitled to God realization. Similarly, let no one think that because he is born in a low caste, he cannot realize the Lord. Guru Amar Das relentlessly repudiates caste, creed and religion, saying, those without Naam are all of low caste. They will become maggots crawling in filth. Those who come into the world as human beings but do not remember the Lord belong to the lowest of the castes and will without doubt descend to be the lowest kind of creatures. On the other hand, regardless of their lineage, caste or religion, those who love the Lord belong to the highest of castes. Guru Arjan says, he who cherishes Shabad within his heart, the greatest king is he. He who has Naam within his heart will fulfill the purpose of his life. Salvation while living comes to him whose heart is the abode of Naam, for such a one knows all the ways. Higher than the highest is the one with Naam in his heart. Without Naam, one wanders through myriad wombs. One who gains human birth, follows the path of love, constantly listens to the divine melody of Shabad, and becomes completely absorbed in its practice, is truly of the highest caste. After his brief sojourn on the earth plane, he will go back and merge in the Lord. If the Lord had any caste, creed or country, then the same would no doubt be true of the soul. But the Lord has no such attributes, so every saint takes us away from these narrow divisions of caste, creed and religion and kindles in us true love for the Lord. The Lord is within. By meeting the Lord, our souls can escape the miseries of repeated births and deaths. All saints declare on the basis of their own knowledge and experience that the Lord is nowhere outside us. He dwells innermost part of our heart. The microcosm holds the macrocosm. Whoever realizes him does so within himself, and whoever will realize him hereafter will also find him within the human body. If there is one laboratory where we may carry out research in order to find God, it is this temple of the human body. All saints give the same message. Guru Amar Das says, the Lord who has given life to the entire creation, who is the supreme giver, who nurtures and sustains everyone, resides within the human body. He further states, in this cave of the body is an inexhaustible treasury where also resides the invisible and infinite Lord. And again he says, within the body he himself resides, the invisible one who cannot be seen, but those who are foolish and proud understand not and go searching for him outside. The Lord lives in the human body, but we search for him outside with our physical eyes. We cannot see him because we are slaves of the mind. How foolish we are! When we lose something inside a house, how can we ever find it by searching for it in the streets outside? Kabir Sahib states the same truth. Like oil in the sesame seed, fire in the flint, within you is your beloved. Wake up and realize him if you can. As the pupil is in the eye, so is the creator in the body. The foolish know it not and go searching for him outside. He for whom you have searched the four corners of the earth, he is within, you fail to see him because he lives behind the veil of illusion. The Lord dwells within this human temple. we are very foolish not to go to the place where we can find him. Instead, we run around in circles. We retire to forests, to mountain caves, or to mosques and temples, but we never succeed in meeting him. Between us and the Lord, there is a blinding screen of illusion, and that is why we are unable to see him. Tulsi Sahab, a great saint who lived in Hathras, Uttar Pradesh, points out, "Why are you wandering about searching for the friend? The path to the beloved is through the royal vein. There is little use in our searching for the Lord outside when all the time he is within this body of clay. The way to reach him is also within this microcosm. Christ explains in the Bible that the kingdom of God is within you." Paltu Sahab says, "Why are you crying out, 'Lord, Lord,' the Lord is right there with you. The Lord walks with us throughout all the 24 hours of the day and night." Guru Amar Das says, "He who brought this universe into being is ever present. Regard him not as distant from you. The Lord who created the world is not far away from you. All the time he is with you in your own body. It is in this wondrous cave that you must search to discover him." Dadu Sahab gives a comprehensive picture of this truth, saying, "O Dadu, man knows not God, and yet God is so close by. Out of touch with the Guru's word, he wanders lost and alone. He thinks that God is far, and far he does remain. Yet he is here, there, everywhere. Without the eye, he cannot be seen. That is why he seems far away. Some run to find him in Dwarka, some to Kashi or Mathura, and all the time the Lord is right within. God lives in every man, but rare is the one who knows it. He alone realizes God, who loves him. At times we think that perhaps the Lord is hidden behind the skies. The fact is that we look for him everywhere else except within the human body, the only place where he can be discovered." Guru Amar Das says, "The lover of the Lord searches for him within. All others wander in delusion. The real devotees and lovers of the Lord, who have had the good fortune to keep the company of a saint, look for him within their own body. All others wander here and there, always filled with doubts and uncertainty, always far from the truth." The Punjabi saint Bulle Shah says, "The Lord, O Bulla, is not separate from us. Apart from him, there is none else. But we have not the eye that sees, so we suffer the pangs of separation." Kabir Sahib, in his usual forceful manner, says, "With stones both large and small is built the mosque, to the tower of which the mullah climbs and cries till he is hoarse, as though the Lord were deaf. Why does the mullah shout? Know ye not, O mullah, that the invisible is not hard of hearing, and that he whom you invoke so loudly lives within your heart? To the mosque goes the Turk, to the temple goes the Hindu, rushing about in their own ways, but within the body is the invisible Lord. Him they do not see. We build the house of the Lord with brick and stone. The priest stands high on top of its tower and calls out loudly to God. Evidently, this must be a deaf God who does not hear our call." Kabir Sahib tells the priest that the Lord is not hard of hearing and that he need not make such a great outcry. "The Lord for whom you shout so loudly lives within you," says Kabir. "Muslims search for him in mosques, Hindus in temples, Sikhs and Christians in their gurdwaras and churches, yet he eludes them all. Unless they enter the sanctum sanctorum of their own shrine, the human body, they cannot find the indescribable one, for he lives within and can only be found there." Tulsi Sahab says, "What a pity, the tragedy of it. You go to man-made temples and mosques and suffer hardships in vain, while all the time the real mosque is within you." Bulle Shah fearlessly states the same truth. "Burn your formal prayers, stamp fasting into the mud, to hell with reciting the creed. Bulla has found the Lord within, but people roam around in ignorance and error." He further says, "I read the Vedas, I read the Quran, I read to the point of exhaustion. I bowed in prayer so much my forehead became worn. But God is not in pilgrimages, nor is he at Mecca. Whoever found him within, my friend." How sad it is that we go to the places we ourselves have built, treating them as dwelling places for the Lord,
and searching for him there day and night. Yet we completely ignore the human body, which is the real shrine where he actually lives. If there is any true temple, true gurudwara, true mosque or true church, then it is this body of ours. This is the place God has designed for himself. He is sitting within it. Kabir Sahib says, complete, entire and ever-present is the one true Lord within the body of each man, the Lord who is beyond all bonds. Saint Paul also calls the human body the temple of the living God. The Hindu sages and seers call it the body that is the creation of God and in which he abides, Nar Narayani Deh. Guru Amar Das also says the same thing. This body is the temple of God. He is realized through the jewel of true knowledge. This body is the only real temple of the Lord, and it is only within this body that we can gain real knowledge of him. Just consider for a moment how we go and look for the Lord in mosques, temples and churches that we have built ourselves, instead of looking for him in God's own temple where he is himself ever present. We keep our religious places neat and clean and do not let even a speck of dirt lie there. We refrain from doing anything bad and hesitate even to utter an unworthy word there. For we believe that these places are meant to be the Lord's dwellings and therefore their sanctity must be maintained. But the place that the Lord has himself chosen to dwell in is often kept quite dirty and unclean. At one time it is filled with animal flesh and strong drink. At another it is fed with vicious thoughts. Imagine what sins we stoop to and what wicked deeds we do in God's own temple. We greatly value our man-made places of worship, but we treat his own temple with such disdain. The study of history puts us to shame because it shows that even when just a single brick is accidentally dislodged in one of these man-made temples, we go to war and kill thousands of God's own temples, namely human beings. Kabir Sahib says, Ram is ours, say the Hindus, to Rahman do the Muslims lay claim. Both fight it out to the death without ever learning the secret. In the name of religion, many wars and battles have been fought. What bloodshed and suffering have been caused? How many children have been orphaned? How many women have been widowed? And yet we think with great pride that we are saviors of religion. We call ourselves martyrs of the faith. If we could find the Lord by cutting one another's throats, what could be easier? But this idea is completely wrong. Those who love the Lord also love his creation. When there is only one Lord, when it is he who has created us all, when he dwells within all of us, and it is within the body that we have to look for him, then to hate one another is to hate the Lord. If one nation despises another, if one religion is hungering after the blood of another, then in that nation or in that religion, love for the Lord is not yet born. Those who love the Lord constantly give love to his creation. If we hate his creatures, we also hate the Lord. Guru Amar Das says, all creatures, big or small, are his, and he is the Lord of all. Whom shall I call bad when there is none but he? The one true Lord created all of us. He dwells within each one of us. We could only call a person base or evil if there were some other God present within him or if he had been created by someone else. Kabir Sahib says, first God created the light, all beings too are his creation. When from the one light the whole world was born, who can be called good, who bad? Saint John says in the Bible, that was the true light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Nobody is good or bad. All are settling the account of their karmas. The light and splendor of the Lord is the heritage of all human beings. Therefore, saints always tell us that the search for the Lord should be carried out within oneself, because seeking him elsewhere is bound to end in failure. If the God is within the true temple of our body, the question naturally arises to why we do not see him. What is the obstacle in the way and how can this be removed? Guru Arjan says, a great wonder is this, in the same house live the two, the soul and her Lord, ever in each other's company, and yet how strange, they never speak the one to the other. The Lord within is invisible, he cannot be seen, because of the veil of illusion that lies in between. Both the Lord and the soul live together in the same house, yet the two do not meet. The soul is within the body, and so also is the Lord, but the soul has neither seen the Lord nor met him.
the barrier of ego. The saints say that our ego, our pride or egotism is the greatest barrier that prevents us from meeting the Lord. Guru Nanak says, each one from ego takes his birth and clad in ego dies and comes and goes, gives and receives and earns and spends and deals in lies or speaks the truth in ego all the while. Bad deeds and good deeds and cogitations, heaven and hell and incarnations, all these from ego are not free. Guru Angad says, this ego is a long-standing disease, but its cure is also within. If God in heaven sends His grace, then through the Guru's Shabad, the disciple does the self-efface. Guru Nanak says, only he is liberated while living who has rid himself of ego. We can get salvation while living if we can remove all traces of our ego. Guru Amar Das says, the Lord is ever true and higher than the highest is, but you must crush your ego to realize Him. The Lord is eternal, He is the highest of the high. He lives in Sachkhand, but as long as the barrier of ego is not removed, we cannot meet Him. Dadu Sahib explains the same truth, saying, boast not, O Dadu, be humble, make no big claims and live in lowliness. How many have come and gone in this grocer's shop? There is nothing in this world that anyone can own or claim as his. Everything belongs to the Lord. Regard everything as the Lord's and do not try to possess anything as your own. Worldly objects have never accompanied anybody after death, nor will they ever do so. Many a king and ruler has tried his best to make the world his own, but all have failed. It is our attachment, our ego, that keeps us tied to the wheel of recurring births and deaths. This same truth is referred to by Christ in the Bible when He says, and again I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. It is not possible for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, nor can the rich man who gives all his attention to the pleasures and possessions of this world ever meet the Lord. Bulle Shah says, banish duality from your heart and be free from all disputes. The Turk and the Hindu are not different. Look on all as holy, not as thieves, for the Lord is in every single one. Kabir Sahib says, lust may be driven out, but anger lingers, and greed will stay when anger goes. And then when greed is gone, vainglory, vanity and the wish to be honored fill the emptiness left in the mind. What is ego? It is all our talk about my and mine, about my family, my possessions, my wealth, my honor or my glory. In reality, all these belong to the Lord. We believe ourselves to be separate from Him and try our best to make the objects of the world our own. But these things have never belonged to anyone, nor will they ever do so. The effort that we make to possess them lead us into a quagmire of worthless attachments. We become so fond of these worldly forms and shapes that we even dream of them during our sleep. At the time of death, they appear before us like pictures on a cinema screen. Whatever we think of at the time of our death, that we become. And then, bound by our attachments to the things of which we think most deeply, we plunge headlong into another birth. Christ says in the Bible that a man's foes shall be they of his own household, of one's true relatives. He says, for whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother. Controlling the mind. Who or what is in love with the world and attached to the objects in it? It is our mind. Therefore, if there is any obstacle between the soul and the Lord, it is truly our mind. It is for this reason that Guru Nanak says, he who conquers the mind conquers the world. When you conquer the mind, you automatically detach yourself from the world as well, and you make both mind and its creator your own. If we have one worst enemy in all the world, it is our mind, for at one time it is our friend, at another our foe. If you consider the matter carefully, you will discover that it is under the influence of the mind that religion fights against religion, nation against nation, and brother against brother. Each wishes to get the best of the other. We spend so much time planning and plotting to harm others. The prime architect of all this is our mind. Therefore, as long as we do not control the mind, we cannot realize the Lord and become one with Him.
What do we mean by controlling the mind? The mind is no mean power. Just as the soul is of the essence of the Lord, so the mind is of the essence of Brahm. Its origin is in Trikuti, the second spiritual stage. But alas, caught in the network of illusion, it has forgotten its place of origin. The soul has become its handmaid and both are tied together, as it were, in a knot. Until the soul gives up the company of the mind, it can never know itself, nor can it know its own source. It leaves the company of the mind only when the mind returns to its place of origin. Therefore, whatever efforts we make must be directed towards undoing the knot of the mind in the soul. Know thyself, says Socrates. Guru Amar Das says, he alone is pure who has realized his self. Kabir Sahib affirms, O Sadhu, my master made the invisible visible when he made me realize myself. Swamiji says, you must realize your own self, be not led away by what others may say. Truly to know thyself means to rise above the domain of matter and mind, to remove from the soul the three coverings, namely the physical, astral and causal bodies, and to rise above the three attributes of gunas, harmony, activity and inertia. Only then does one know oneself. Our soul was originally pure, spotless and holy, but because of its association with the mind, it has become extremely impure and unclean. For example, the water in the clouds is pure, but when it falls on the ground as rain, it mixes with earth and gathers numerous impurities. It even begins to have an unpleasant smell. It then completely loses sight of its original reality and purity and begins to think that it is nothing but muddy earth. However, when the heat of a bright sun raises it up as vapor, it realizes in a flash what it really is, as it rises up and merges back into its source, the clouds. The condition of our soul is like that of rain. Caught in the closely woven net of the illusion of this world, the soul has become completely subservient to the mind. In its turn, the mind has become fond of sense pleasures. Whatever the mind does, the soul has to suffer the consequences. Unless it gives up its association with the mind, it is not worthy to merge in its source. Saint Charan Das says, mind is a slave to the senses, intellect is a slave to the mind. Tell me how one can become immersed in contemplation of the Lord in such a disordered world as this. An electric bulb, however strong it may be, can emit no light if it is covered over with a dozen layers of thick black cloth. In spite of its light, the room it is in will be in utter darkness. But as we begin to remove the covers, the room will grow brighter, and on the removal of the last cover, it will become brightly lit. In the same way, as our soul begins to leave the company of the mind and to shed its covers, it begins to know itself. That is why it is said that self-realization is essential before God-realization. All our endeavors, all our efforts, all our struggles and all our techniques we use must be directed towards subjugating the mind and withdrawing it to its source at the top of the second spiritual region. Every religion has the same aim and puts emphasis on subduing the mind. We try in a thousand ways to control the mind. We turn for help to the recital of holy books, to penances, to worship and bathing in holy rivers, to the reading of scriptures and religious books, to almsgiving and charities, to burning incense and sacred fires. We even leave our homes and go into the solitude of forests. We hide ourselves in mountain caves. Through discipline, we try to detach our mind from the objects of the world. But because our thoughts do not become attached to something superior, something beyond, our mind reacts and rebounds and comes back into the world with as much strength and cunning as ever. To control the mind with force is like putting a viper in a basket. So long as the lid of the basket is tightly closed, we remain safe from the venom of the viper. But the moment the viper escapes, it'll again bite. Merely by putting a viper in a basket, we cannot be free from fear. There is always a danger and risk to our life. If, instead, we catch hold of the viper and remove its poisonous fangs, it becomes absolutely harmless and we can go about wearing it round our neck. There is then no danger to our life and we need not fear the viper. In the same way,
We do not gain control of the mind by renouncing the world and running away into forests and mountain caves. When we face the world again, the same cravings and desires of the mind which have lain dormant for a time will make us dance to their tune once again. The fact is that our condition then becomes even worse than that of ordinary people, because the more we suppress a thing, the more it revolts. Controlling the mind by strict discipline is like covering a live charcoal with ashes. Apparently the fire is dead, but when a gust of wind blows, the ashes are scattered and the fire comes alive once more. In the same way, when the storm of passions arises, the mind gets out of control and runs into impetuous actions with redoubled force.
Forcible control of the mind may also be likened to handing over a criminal to the police. So long as the criminal remains in the custody of the police, we are safe from his criminal behavior. However, the moment he is released, he returns once more to a life of crime, and we have to contend once again with his wickedness. On the other hand, if we can really reform the criminal by our wise advice, and so make him a good citizen, we will be freed forever from his evil deeds. For this reason, the saints advise us that we can never subdue the mind through forcible discipline. We may obtain a certain amount of relief and peace for a while, but we cannot control the mind for all time. If we wish to subdue the mind, we have to study its nature and habits. From experience, we know that the mind is fond of pleasure. It may love something or someone very much, but the moment it comes across something better, it leaves the first and runs after the second. No love or attachment can ever keep the mind constant or stable. At one time we were ready to sacrifice our life to possess certain things, thinking that we could not do without them. Then they lost their appeal, so that now we may not even wish to set our eyes on them. We generally say that the mind is fond of variety. It tires of constantly seeing or eating the same thing. If we look back over our lives, we find that in our childhood we dearly love our parents, so that if our mother is absent for no more than 2 minutes, we begin to cry. Later, when we have brothers and sisters, the same love is given to them. When we go to schools and colleges, the same love is transferred to friends and companions. When we get married, our wife and children monopolize our love. In old age, our love is given to caste, creed, and country. It is the same love, but it takes so many forms and is given to so many different people and things. No one love can ever keep the mind fixed. Until the mind gets something superior, nobler, and higher than worldly love, it'll never be ready under any circumstances to give up the pleasures of the world. What is that superior love for which our mind will give up its worldly love and attachments? Saints tell us that it is the taste of Shabad or Naam, the word or logos, the inner unstruck music, which is so sweet and so transcendent and so captivating that our mind automatically becomes completely satisfied and calm. Those who get rubies and diamonds have no use for pennies. Girls play with dolls only until they are married. Only attachment to something higher and finer can bring about detachment in us. If a young girl were to be advised before her marriage that she should give up her love for her parents, her brothers and sisters, her friends and companions, it would be difficult, even impossible, for her to do so. But when she actually does get married and has won the love of her husband, then automatically her love is transferred to her husband. She naturally forgets her parents, her brothers and sisters, and her friends and companions. If we try to snatch away a single penny from a beggar, he'll fight desperately for it. If we put gold coins into his hands, he will naturally let go of his pennies. Guru Arjan gives a vivid description of the nature of the mind. I recited the scriptures and studied the Vedas. I performed nearly yoga practice to cleanse my system. I aroused the kundalini, still the five foes I could not cast out. On the contrary, ego increased more and more. No, these are not the roads, my dear friend, that lead Godwards. Believe me, innumerable such paths have I traversed in vain.
Guru Arjan says that neither the reading of scriptures, nor their recital, neither pranayam, control of the breath, nor hatha yoga can succeed in casting out the five foes:
lust, greed, anger, attachment, and ego. Then he says, I took the vow of silence and contented myself with as much food as lay within the hollow of my palm. Through the forests I ranged all naked, to the four corners of the earth I travelled.
I visited all the holy rivers and places of pilgrimage, but I could not shake off the mind's habitual wavering.
Urged on by my mind, I settled at a holy place. I permitted myself to be sawn in two, but even with a million such practices, the filth of the mind does not go.
We may take to silence. We may leave our hearth and home and run away to forests and mountain caves. We may discard our clothes and go naked. We may leave behind all household utensils and use our hands for taking food and drink. We may go on pilgrimages to holy places. We may even subject ourselves to all sorts of arduous or painful practices, but still the mind will not lose its dirt and its attachment to worldly objects. To control the mind, we may even go to Kashi, Banaras, and be cut to pieces by the sacred saw called Karvat. We may subject our bodies to severe penances, but the mind will still remain as full of doubts as ever. Bulle Shah says the same thing in his own way. The Lord does not reside in mosques, nor is the Kaaba his abode. The Quran and other scriptures do not contain him, nor is he to be found in saying prayers. I did not see him at pilgrim places and tired out my feet for nothing. But when Bulla found his master, all demands and debts were erased. There is only one way to subdue the mind, and that is to give it the sweet and enchanting taste of the name, the word, or logos. As it gets the taste of the name, it begins to shed its love for the world. The sweetness and the magnetic pull of the word will remove all its attachments. Swamiji explains, it is by listening to the music of Shabad that the mind is brought under control. A million other labors will fail to touch it. The yogi labors hard at yogic practices. The scholar seeks through learning. The ascetic tries himself with penances, and the anchorite with his austerities. The hermit sits aloof, meditating on one or another image in the mind. He too is in delusion. The pandit reads the Vedas and expounds their philosophy, but the distinction that his learning brings is futile. Of what account are intellect and cleverness? Even scholars repent in the end. No action is effective. The only way to absorb oneself in the music of the Shabd. When one meets a master who knows the secret of Shabd, he implants the pain of longing in the disciple. The soul starts listening to the Shabd and the mind begins to come under control. Swamiji elsewhere describes the person who has vanquished his mind as an intrepid warrior. Mind is a deadly enemy, and since it is within the body, it is extremely difficult to conquer it. Swamiji advises the devotee to apply himself only to this task and not to waste his time in other efforts. He says that the way to control the mind is to develop love for the master and to listen to the divine melody within, both essential for subduing the mind, and that there is no need for any other practice. Similarly, Guru Amar Das says, through the true Naam, the mind becomes purified. Through devotion to truth, the pain and misery are driven out. It is only the practice of the true Name that purifies the mind and makes it clear and clean. It is this practice alone that saves us from the wheel of births and deaths. Guru Nanak explains by a very apt illustration, if it hears the Guru's mantra, the mind snake is rid of its poison. Absorbed in Naam, it becomes tranquil. If a person is bitten by a snake, he is immediately taken to a doctor. The effect of the poison is counteracted and the victim is made well. In the same way, if we wish to remove the poison of the snake of our mind, we must go to a lover of God, a master, and in accordance with his teachings, join our mind with the indwelling power known as the name or word. There is no other way to control the mind. Guru Nanak says, Ram Naam, the name of God, has pierced my mind. Why then think of other means? Our mind is entangled in worldly love and attachments and wanders about aimlessly like a deer, which has musk in its navel but runs madly around in the forest trying to find it. But when the mind comes in contact with Naam or Shabd, name or word, it becomes motionless forever. It is futile to think about or to try any other method to quiet the mind. Thus Swamiji says, to Surat Shabd devote yourself and leave aside all other efforts.
Chapter 3.
within the temple of the body.
The true name. If we study the teachings of any saint, we will find that each one praises Naam or the name of God. We have many religions and each has its own rites and rituals, ceremonies and formalities. But the reality, the essence of truth and spirituality at the base of each one of them is the same. All saints create in us a longing and love for the spirituality. They all explain the way to attain this reality. It is this truth that saints in different countries, in different religions and in different times have come to reveal to humanity. The Hindu saints have called this reality God's name, Ram Naam, God's inner music, Ram Dhun, the pure sound, Nirmal Nad, divine sound, Divya Dhuni, etc. Guru Nanak generally calls this same reality the name, Naam or word, Shabd. It is the same power that he calls the sound from the beyond, from the original source, Dhurki Bani, true or real sound, Sachi Bani, God's command, Hukam, unspeakable tale, Akath Katha, and God's music, Hari Kirtan. Muslim saints refer to it as inner sound, Kalma, the greatest name, Ism-e-Azam, the sound from the sky, Bang-e-Asmani, the voice of God, Kalam-e-Ilahi, or King of Repetitions, Sultanul Azkar. Christ calls it the Word or Logos. In the Rig Veda, it is called Word, Vak. We should have no dispute over words as such. We should search for the reality that each saint glorifies and by means of which our mind is completely satisfied and goes back and merges in its source. We must understand what the saints mean by the name or word, where exactly it exists, how we can join our consciousness with it, and why we need to do this. Until we understand this, we may go on reading the scriptures and the teachings of the saints for the whole of our life, but we can never get the full benefit from them. In the teachings of the saints, there is frequent mention of the true name. Guru Amar Das says, "It is through true name that true honor is achieved. Thus, there must be another name or bani which is not true." Here truth means something which is eternal, birthless and deathless. Saints tell us that the word or the name is of two kinds. One is called Varnatmak and the other Dhunatmak. A Varnatmak name is one that can be read, written and spoken. All names such as God, Lord, Allah, Vaheguru, Radha Swami, Hari Om, Paramatma, Parmeshwar and so on are Varnatmak names. In every language we remember the Lord by a number of names. These names having been used by saints who have already visited the world. Many more saints will still come and they will perhaps employ numerous other names for the Lord. We tend to forget many of the old names and in our love for the Lord continue to invent new ones. We can trace the history of each such name and determine who first used it and when it was first used. Swamiji appeared on this planet barely a century ago. We began calling the Supreme Father Radha Swami after him. We forget that before his advent, the world was still here and so were we. The same Lord was also there and we remembered him by many different names. Similarly, with the advent of Guru Nanak, we started calling the Lord Vaheguru. But it is only 500 years ago that Guru Nanak came. After Prophet Muhammad, we began calling the Lord Allah. But it is barely 1400 years ago that Prophet Muhammad came. Likewise, after Lord Ramchandra, we began remembering the Lord as Ram. And that must have been 10,000 years or so ago. The fact is that every name by which we remember the Lord can be traced historically. There are four different kinds of Varnatmak names. The first is spoken with the tongue in the same way that we talk with each other. The second is spoken slowly in the throat. The third is spoken in the heart. And the fourth is repeated by yogis while concentrating on their navel. All these words are Varnatmak and none of them is true or eternal. They all vanish in the course of time. Swamiji states in his teachings, "Let me explain to you, O brother, the secret of Naam and the way to distinguish between the two types thereof. Varnatmak is the first type. It is also called Akshar, alphabet, and it includes every type of name that is uttered by the tongue. In short, all names that you can speak, read or write are known as Varnatmak. The name that can be read, written and spoken, the name whose history can be traced,
whose time and limit can be determined is called Varnatmak by saints. The name that all saints glorify, that gives salvation, that enables us to control the mind, that helps us to untie the knot of the soul and the mind, that makes us know ourselves and realize the Lord, is called Dhunatmak by the saints. This name is the true name. It is imperishable. It can neither be read, written, nor spoken. Huzur Maharaj Ji used to call it the unwritten law and the unspoken language. Christ also referred to the light and sound of this name when he said, "Because they seeing see not, and hearing they hear not, but blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear." Guru Angad praises the name in these terms: "See without eyes and walk without feet, and work and speak and hear, but use no hand nor tongue nor ear. Thus while living die and realize the law, O Nanak, then alone the Beloved you will meet." The physical eyes do not see this name, nor do the physical ears hear it. Neither do our feet carry us there, nor can it be caught by our hands. To attain it and to meet the Lord, we need to die while living. The Varnatmak names are our means, while the Dhunatmak name is our end and object. We should not become involved in disputes about mere words. Instead, we should try to discover the true name with the help of a master. Unfortunately, what do we see in this world? Those who remember the Lord as Vaheguru begin to call themselves Sikhs, while those who remember Him as Allah call themselves Muslims, and those who remember Him as Ram call themselves Hindus. We become so intolerant that it becomes difficult for us even to meet each other. We never stop to think where this wrangling over words is leading us. If only we could merge with the true name, all strife and discord could come to an end at once. It has been stated earlier that we do not really have any caste or creed or country. Conflict lasts only while we are deaf to the music of the true name and are in love with the names that are expressed in words. Every master comes to remove our doubts and false beliefs and to join us to the true name. The mother in her love calls her children by many different names, but the relationship of the mother with her children is not one of words or names. These are merely spoken expressions of her love. Love is one thing and the words another. In the same way, the lovers and devotees of the Lord remember Him by a variety of names. In reality, He is nameless. As Maulana Rum says in the Masnavi, "I begin with the name of He who is nameless but who answers, whatever name one may use." The words or names for God simply express the love of His devotees, and these Varnatmak names are reflections of their love. The true name, however, is quite different. No history of this name can be traced, nor can it be limited by time or space. The true name created the universe and now sustains the universe. It is a divine power and is our only support. Guru Amar Das says, "Through Shabd all creation emanates, by Shabd it is dissolved, and through Shabd it is created again." The word, Logos or Shabad, created the world. The moment the Lord withdraws this indwelling power which sustains all things, the universe undergoes dissolution or grand dissolution. The entire creation is comprised of five vital elements or tattvas: earth, water, fire, air and ether. Everything we see in the world has one or more of these elements active in it. All the five elements are antagonistic to one another, but they are kept together and sustained by the indwelling power of the Word. When this immanent power is withdrawn, water dissolves earth, fire dries up water, air dissipates fire, and ether consumes air. The whole world, in fact, is annihilated. For example, our body is made up of five elements. So long as we have the ray of the name in us, we are alive and active in the world. When this power is withdrawn, the body dies and decays. The five elements go back to join their source. Our body ceases to exist. Saints explain that the whole universe is maintained in the same way by the word or logos, the true name. Guru Arjan says, "Nam sustains all beings, the regions and universes, skies and nether worlds, sacred cities and the whole world, all are sustained by Nam." Guru Amar Das says that everything one sees in the world is created by Nam. Saint John writes in the Bible,
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. The rishis and munis of ancient India state in the Vedas that it is through the divine word from the heavens, Akashvani, that the world was made. It is said in the Quran that the word Kalma created the 14 tabaks, regions of the world. According to ancient Chinese philosophy, it is Tao that created the world. Guru Nanak says, Shabd created the earth, Shabd created the sky. Through Shabd emanated light, the entire world is sustained by Shabd. Shabd, O Nanak, dwells in every being. Shah Nyas says, through the world came into being. Through the word, the carpet of light was spread for His presence. How can then one fix the time or trace the history of this power, which created the entire universe? It is this true word or name that is essential in attaining liberation, and it is found within the body. Unless we search for it within ourselves, join ourselves to it and completely merge in it, we can never obtain salvation. Guru Amar Das says, it is the true Shabd that brings true honor in the court of the Lord. Without devotion to Naam, no one can gain salvation. Guru Amar Das also says, they who know not Shabd are blind and deaf. Why did they come at all into this world? Without Shabd, there is utter darkness within. One neither finds the precious thing nor escapes from the rounds of birth and death. So long as we do not discover the word, the darkness of ignorance within us is not dispelled. We are unable to realize God and we cannot escape from the cycle of births and deaths. One who dies in the Shabd becomes perfect, proclaims Sadguru the valiant warrior. Christ says in the Bible, if ye continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Stating the same truth in a different way, he says, that God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. Kabir Sahab says, just as a stack of hay is reduced to ashes by a single spark, so are all sins consumed the moment Naam enters the heart. When the name enters into the inner recesses of our heart, all our karmic accounts are settled. It is because of our karmas that we are imprisoned in bodies. However high a stack of hay may be, a small spark of fire reduces it to ashes in an instant. So also are our sins washed away by the practice of the name. Guru Ramdas says, one may bring wood from far and near and stack it in a heap, but a little fire reduces it to ashes. Even so is soon consumed one's great store of sins when saints apply to the sinner a spark of Naam of the Lord. Swamiji points out the same truth when he says that Shabd destroys the accumulated karmas. Shabd merges one in the ocean of Shabd. Christ says in the Bible, now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. The word that I have given you, he says, has completely washed away all your sins. Kabir Sahib speaks of the power of the name in a most emphatic manner, saying, all praise to the leper in the name absorbed, although his body ulcerates and wastes away. What worth is that body perfect as gold but devoid of the name? The leper whose body is wasting away but whose soul is in contact with the name is far more fortunate than the man who has all worldly pleasures and possessions but has completely forgotten the Lord. The name that saints praise so highly is not anywhere outside, it is within our body. Guru Amar Das says, he who seeks the Lord outside does not find Naam and suffers great pain. Those who look for the name outside their bodies do not find it. If something is inside the house, how can we ever find it by searching for it outside? Simran and Dhyan. Our spiritual journey begins at the soles of our feet and ends at the top of our head. The journey has two stages, one up to the eyes, and the other above the eyes. The seat of the soul and the mind in our body lies hidden behind and between our two eyes, at a point sometimes called the third eye or single eye. Muslims call this point the black point, Nukta-e-Saveda. The sages and seers of ancient India called it the eye of Shiv, Shivnetra, or the divine eye, Divya-Chakshu. Guru Nanak called it Til or Tisra Til.
Whenever we have to remember a thing that we have forgotten, our hand instinctively goes to our forehead, never to our legs or feet. The point between and behind the two eyes is vitally connected with our thinking. Everybody's attention descends from this point and spreads into the world through the 9 portals of the body. Guru Ram Das says, every minute the mind wanders lost in delusion. It never settles down in the till its home. Word is the remedy, the goad that master places on our head. Then alone does the mind settle down in its home, the temple of the body. We constantly wander out into the world from the third eye, and our mind does not remain still even for an instant. So long as the mind wanders, it can never go back to its source in Trikuti, the second spiritual region. Our attention flows out into the whole world through the 9 portals or apertures of the body. The 2 eyes, 2 ears, 2 nostrils, the mouth and the 2 lower apertures. Even if we were to sit in a dark room and lock the door, our mind would not stay locked up in the room. It would wander away into the whole world. The mind's constant habit of thinking of worldly affairs, people and things is called Simran or repetition by the masters. Everybody has this natural habit. Some people are thinking about or doing the Simran of their children, some of their domestic affairs, some of their office work, and whoever we think about, their forms automatically come before our eyes. This visualizing of others is called Dhyan, contemplation by the saints. Gradually, as we form the habit of thinking about and contemplating on certain people and things, our love and attachment for them grows accordingly. In the course of time, the mind develops so much affinity and association with them that we begin to see them even in our dreams, and at the time of our death, their shapes and forms will stand vividly before our eyes. If we think at this last moment of some worldly person, place or thing, we will return to this world to be with it. In fact, it is because we are entangled in love and attachment for worldly images and things that we come back again and again to this world of phenomena. Saints or masters explain that we are already in the habit of Simran and Dhyan. We should make the best use of this natural habit. Contemplation of transient and short-lived objects and attachment to them brings us back to this world of tragedy and tears. But if we contemplate the eternal, we will attain the eternal, of which our soul is a particle and with which it wishes to merge. Guru Arjan says, eternal only is the deathless God, and he who dwells upon him becomes eternal too. The Supreme Lord is permanent and eternal. He is birthless and deathless. Those who remember him and always think of him will become immortal like him. They will end the cycle of births and deaths. We should therefore focus our attention behind the eyes by Simran, as taught to us by a master, along with Dhyan, which will hold it there. This practice is so simple and easy that a child of 5 or an adult of 100 can do it without difficulty. We have a natural habit of doing Simran. We have merely to change it from Simran of the world and its objects to Simran of the Lord, from the transient to the eternal. In this way, our attention is brought back and becomes concentrated at the third eye. At first, it will not stay there because it has the habit of dropping down and wandering out into the world through the 9 openings. It is difficult to make the mind still in darkness and in emptiness unless we give it some form upon which to contemplate. Thus, the necessity of Dhyan arises when our mind becomes fully concentrated by Simran at the eye center. Then Dhyan is needed to hold it there and prevent it from slipping down. On what form should we contemplate? This is an important matter and needs careful consideration because one can become strongly attached to whatever form the mind contemplates. Bound by love for that form, the mind will go wherever the form goes. We must do our best, therefore, to determine which object or form is most worthy of our worship and contemplation. The world and its objects, the saints tell us, are all constituted of the 5 vital elements: water, earth, fire, air and ether. In everything, one or more of them is active. Man has been called the darling of the universe and the top of the creation, whom God made in his own image. He is the microcosm that holds the macrocosm, the pot of clay that has God within it. He has all the 5 elements active.
He is a doll, so to say, fabricated out of them.
The first category of created things is only one element active, water, and comprises the entire vegetable kingdom. If we humans, in whom all five elements are active, worship plants and trees, we'll make no spiritual progress, since worshipping them will bring us back to plant life. Therefore, objects belonging to the plant and vegetable kingdom are not worthy of our worship and contemplation. The second category of created things is that of the insects and reptiles. They have two elements active in them. Insects have fire and air, and reptiles have earth and fire. They too are not fit for our worship. The third class is that of the birds, which have three active elements, water, fire, and air. If we were to worship birds, we would doubtless become birds in a subsequent life, with the result that our aim of rising above the human level would be defeated. The fourth category is comprised of animals which lack only the element of ether, possession of which would give them the power of discrimination. Thus, cows, horses, and the like do not merit our worship either. The fifth category is that of human beings themselves, who have all the five elements active. One is naturally prompted to ask why one man should worship another, particularly in the present democratic order of things in which all people are said to have equal rights. Nobody has seen any of the many gods and goddesses, so no one can contemplate on their real forms. We cannot understand the speech of animals, so they are not able to give us spiritual guidance. No one knows the form of God. Because of this, many people become atheists. We are puzzled about what or whom we should worship. Saints solve this problem by giving an illustration that is easy for us to understand. If there are a number of radio sets in a room which are not connected to a power source, then no matter how much we tune them, we can never get news or music from any country. But if we connect them to batteries or electricity, we can tune them in to give us news or music from anywhere in the world. In the same manner, we have to find a spiritual adept who, though in the human form, is constantly in communion with the Lord. Then by contemplating on Him and loving Him, we can, so to say, tune in to His spiritual power and be connected to the same Lord. It is through devotion to such saints or masters that we can worship the Lord. Guru Arjan says, "The form of the timeless Lord is the saint, the true object of contemplation." And again he says, "Contemplate within on the Guru's form." Swamiji says, "Dear friend, contemplate on the Master's form. Without that, there is no liberation from bondage." Christ also gives the same teaching when he says, "He that hath seen me hath seen the Father. He that loveth me shall be loved of my Father, and I will love him and will manifest myself to him." Through contemplation on the form of the Master, we go back and merge in the Lord. The drop joins the ocean and becomes the ocean. Through contemplation, the mind becomes used to staying at the eye focus or third eye. We should, the saints tell us, contemplate on the form of the Master who has initiated us. When we become concentrated and one-pointed at the eye focus, we will find a sweet melody or sound there which emanates from the house of the Lord. This sweet melody is the heritage of all mankind, whether they are rich or poor, young or old, man or woman. Everyone has an equal right to it. Whether one is a Hindu, a Muslim, a Christian or a Sikh, he alone is on the right path who focuses his attention in the third eye and contacts this divine melody. The saints or masters call this practice dying while living, for by withdrawing our consciousness to the third eye and listening to the music of the sound current or audible life stream, the mind and the soul come out of the tomb of the body and become free from it. With their attachment to the world thus broken, they forget the troubles and miseries of the world and enjoy eternal bliss. Kabir Sahab says, "Death for the world is the greatest fear, but fills my heart with bliss." Guru Nanak says, "Die while living, such is the yoga at which one should labor." Similarly, St. Paul says in the Bible, "I die daily." The Muslim scriptures also bring out the same point, saying, "Die before thy death." Dadu, a celebrated saint, writes in his teachings,
Die, O Dadu, before your death, not like others who all die at death. Guru Amar Das says, through devotion to the Sadguru is one cleansed of filth. Dying while living, he contemplates on the Lord. Darya Sahab, another saint, says, Darya met the great master who destroyed all his sins. By giving him the true word, he dispelled falsehood and illusion. Guru Arjan brings out the same point when he says, the darkness of ignorance is dispelled and the lotus of the heart blossoms. In the Guru's Shabad there is great joy and comfort. In his hands, all boons. The divine melody which resounds at the eye focus in all human beings is called the word or the name by the saints. Different world religions may have different rites and rituals, but their underlying principle, the essence of spirituality, the absolute reality, the basic truth is the same in all of them. It is this spiritual truth that different masters at different times and in different countries have described in various ways. Their words may be different, but they speak of the same ancient wisdom. Christ calls it word or logos. Other saints have called it shabd or word or naam or name. We should not get caught in a tangle of words and miss the reality that the words aim to describe. Rather, we should concentrate at the eye focus where the divine melody is constantly resounding. Guru Amar Das says, he who closes the nine doors and stills his wandering mind enters through the tenth, thus making his own true home, his dwelling place. There the unstruck sound, day and night resounding, is heard by following the Master's advice. It is only when we leave the nine portals of the body and bring our soul currents to the eye focus that we reach the gateway to the Lord's mansion. Our real home is Sachkhand, the region of truth, the fifth spiritual region where our Lord resides. The entrance to it is at the third eye and can be easily recognized because the Shabad resounds at that point. So long as we remain away from this point and do not catch hold of the sound current, salvation remains a distant dream. Christ refers to this point when he says, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. The inner path. If we wish to enter our house, we must first try to find its door. The door of our real home is behind the eyes in Tisra Dil, the third eye or single eye. To open it, we have to knock repeatedly on that door. This knocking on the door means that we reverse the flow of our scattered attention and focus it at the eye center. When we do this repeatedly, the attention is concentrated at the third eye, the door opens and we cross the threshold of the house. The path opens up when we connect our consciousness with the divine melody and this path leads us home. Tulsi Sahab says, listen with attention in the real Kaaba's arch. Hear the voice from the highest is calling you back. Muslims believe that the Hajj pilgrimage to the Kaaba in Mecca brings them salvation. Tulsi Sahab says that the real Kaaba is the human body. Our Hajj begins at the soles of our feet and ends at the top of our head. This Hajj has two stages, one up to the eyes and the other above the eyes. In Mecca, a Muslim priest stands in the arch of the Kaaba and cries aloud for the Lord. Our forehead has the same design as the Kaaba's arch. The kalma or sound current that emanates from the house of the Lord is constantly ringing there. When we come in contact with the sound and follow it, we reach our destination, our true home. Guru Amar Das says, in this body is a multitude of precious things, but one sees them only when one meets Sadguru. Closing the nine doors, one enters the tenth, the door to liberation, and there hears the melody of the unstruck music. This body of ours is not merely a 5 or 6 foot structure of blood, flesh and bones. The Lord has kept countless treasures hidden within it. Even the Lord himself lives within it. But so long as we do not meet a true master, we are not in a position either to carry out research in the body or to meet the Lord. Guru Amar Das is explaining that there are two parts to the body, one below the eyes and one above. In the part of the body below the eyes in the nine apertures, there are only sense pleasures and indulgence of desires. As long as our attention is below the eyes, there is no question of attaining liberation. Reaching the door to liberation and controlling the mind means withdrawing the attention from the body
and centering it between the eyes according to the instructions of the Master. There the unstruck sound is resounding day and night. Guru Amar Das says, "The seeker once attached to the Guru's Shabd is never parted from it. He effortlessly merges with truth. When by the grace of a true master we are brought into the magnetic field of the word or logos, it pulls us towards itself and draws us upwards to the Lord. With the help of its sound we must find the direction of our true home. With help of its light we are to follow the path to it. The soul's power of seeing is called Nirat and its power of hearing is called Surat. Surat hears the sound of the word and Nirat sees its radiance. For example, if we take a walk at night and lose our way in the darkness, we stand perfectly still and listen to see if we can hear any sound coming from the direction of our house. It may be the barking of a dog or the sound of a radio or any other sound. With the help of this sound, we are able to determine the direction of our house. But we then need a light of some kind to show the way and help us to avoid thorny bushes, uneven ground and other hazards. Saints tell us that the Lord has provided both sound and light in each one of us to enable us to reach His mansion. With the sound we are to determine the direction and with the light we complete our spiritual journey home. Kabir Sahab says, "The flame of the inaccessible region burns without wick or oil." Paltu Sahab tells of his experience, "In the inverted well of the inner sky burns a lamp without wick, without oil, and day and night it burns throughout the 6 seasons, the 12 months. Paltu Sahab calls the upper part of our head an inverted well. It is therefore just the opposite of a real well. He tells us that when we withdraw our soul from the 9 portals of the body and concentrate it at the eye focus, we enter into the inverted well. At this point, in every human being, there burns a flame which needs no wick or oil, unlike the lamps we use outside which need both wick and oil. The inner flame keeps burning throughout the 24 hours of the day and night and throughout the changing seasons of the year. It goes out only when a person dies." Swamiji also refers to the inner light at the eye center when he says, "Come, dwell within the eyes, withdraw and become one at this point. Here duality will depart and you will behold the flame." When we step out of the 9 apertures of the body, we leave behind duality and have the experience of oneness. While living under the sway of these 9 apertures, we are attached to the world alone. Being of the world, we are entangled in the web of duality. But when we focus our attention behind the eyes, we free ourselves from duality and see the eternal light. Christ says in the Bible, "The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light." That is to say, when you collect your attention behind the eyes, your body will be filled with the radiance of the inner light. Guru Nanak says, "The unbroken strains of Shabd come from deep within the flame. Those who see the flame and hear the Shabd become attached to the true Lord." Every human being has this flame burning within him. There issues forth from it a sweet and captivating music. Whoever beholds the flame and listens to the celestial music loses interest in the world and develops love for the Lord. We know that lights are lit and bells and conches are used in all places of worship, such as temples, mosques, churches and gurdwaras. Inside a church, candles are lit and bells are rung. Similarly, we find in a Buddhist temple that a flame is kept burning all the time at the altar. Buddhists call it the eternal flame and the monks never let it die out. But the immortal flame that the Lord Buddha speaks of is inside each one of us. Hindus, Sikhs and Jains burn lights, ring bells and blow conches in their temples. Muslims burn lights at night over their tombs and Muslim priests call loudly to the faithful for the prayer and worship. It has perhaps never occurred to us to ask why all religious places have the same symbols of sound and light. In reality, all saints have emphasized the fact that the human body is the only true temple, true mosque or true church. It is in this house of worship that there burns a flame and echoes a divine music, which sounds at first like the bell and the conch and purifies all who give their attention to it. When the saviors of humanity depart,
However, we tend to forget or misinterpret their teachings, and instead of turning inwards and seeing the inner light and hearing the inner sound, we take to ceremonies and rituals, which are of no help, because they are based on external sounds and lights. It is only by going inside and bringing the mind under control that one sees the inner light and hears the inner sound. But in order to see the inner light, we need the collyrium of the Master's knowledge. Guru Amar Das says, "When I applied to my eyes the collyrium of the Guru's true knowledge, light shone forth within and the darkness of ignorance was dispelled. My mind came under control and I was blessed with glory at the door of the Lord." When we follow the example of the saints and put the collyrium of the Word in our eyes, we put an end to darkness and ignorance and behold within ourselves the refulgence of the Lord. In India, it is customary to recommend collyrium, a powder, antimony for weak eyesight. And it is believed that by its use, one's eyesight is restored to normal. This is why Guru Amar Das makes this point in this way. In spite of our eyes, we are blind. We see utter darkness within ourselves. But if we use the collyrium of the Word, concentrate our consciousness at the third eye, and unite it with the Word, then we will rid ourselves of the darkness and behold the flame within. Upon seeing the flame, the mind will become calm and motionless. At present, the mind dances to the tune of the senses. They have completely enslaved it. But when the mind becomes completely absorbed in the inner light, constantly hears the sound of the divine music, and thereby reaches its own place of origin, namely Trikuti, our soul will be released from its tenacious grip. Then it will realize that it is of the essence of the Lord, go back and merge in the Lord. It is only then that it wins true honor and glory in the court of the Lord. Christ says in the Bible, "For judgment I am come into this world, that they which see not might see, and that they which see might be made blind." That is to say, He came into this world for people who have eyes but do not see the Lord. He came to blind them to the world and its objects, so that they turn Godward and see Him. Guru Amar Das says, "They who hear Shabd within realize their real self. They alone attain the highest and are emancipated. Those who get in touch with the Word and realize their true self are alone capable of attaining salvation and finding the path that leads to God." He further says, "Self-realization comes only after knowing the delights of Shabd. We are able to recognize ourselves only when we get the taste of the name or the Word, and by this means remove little by little all coverings over our soul. The saints show us the path that enables us to join our soul with the music of the Word." Guru Nanak says, "Merge yourself with the Shabd, that is the real death. He who dies thus will not have to die again." Swamiji also explains, "Dye yourself in the color of Naam, that you attain your own eternal abode."
The necessity of practice. Saints describe the glory of the name in holy books and scriptures. By studying them, we come to know why it is necessary for us to practice the name and how this is to be done. But the scriptures do not contain the name. They only reveal the method of obtaining it. Salvation does not come by reading them. It becomes a reality only when we practice whatever we have read. Medical books describe methods of curing various diseases, but they do not themselves contain medicines. Even if a patient with some disease were to read books on medicine all day long, he would not be cured. But if he prepares a medicine according to the prescription given in the book and then uses it, he can soon be healthy again. Thus, a book on medicine is one thing and the medicine itself is quite another. Similarly, if a person were to read all day long a book on cooking which gives recipes for making a variety of dishes, he would neither be able to taste them nor satisfy his hunger. Only when he prepares food according to the directions given in the book does he taste the food and satisfy his hunger. If we have to undertake a journey by train, we first carefully consult the railway guide. This tells us the length of the journey, the stations that will pass on the way, the amount of the train fare, and so on. But merely reading the guide will never take us to our destination. It is only when we go to the railway station, buy a ticket and get into the train that we are able to reach our destination. Theoretical knowledge of a subject can never take the place of actual experience. We regard the reading of holy books or the recital of them as means to salvation. Frequently, we do not even read the scriptures ourselves. We have it done by a priest. This is not all. While the reading is going on in our house, we ourselves are going about our daily work. We become vain and think that the reading of scriptures in this way is certain to win great merit for us. If we ourselves were to read and understand the teachings of the masters, we would become conscious of our weaknesses and shortcomings. They would then grow in us a longing to remove our weakness and to learn the method of God realization. Such an attentive reading would, of course, be beneficial. Unfortunately for us, we have made a ritual of the reading of holy books by a priest, and we are foolish enough to imagine that this will bring us salvation by proxy. You may find many noble sentiments in the scriptures, but you cannot attain devotion simply by reading them. Such reading is like churning water from which no butter can ever be produced. Saints, take us out of the maze of such false hopes and foolish consolations. Swamiji says, merely reading and reciting holy scriptures, all pandits have come to grief. Without a true master and without the Surat Shabd practice, no one has ever crossed the dread ocean of this world. Similarly, Guru Nanak says, if one reads for years, month upon month, if one reads for lifetime, breath upon breath, Nanak, only one thing is of value. All else is vain indulgence urged on by ego. That is to say, if we were to read the whole day, the whole month, the whole year, even the whole of our life, only one thing would be credited to our account, and that is whether our soul is united with the word. Otherwise, all our reading and studying is futile. Tulsi Sahab says, if one read the 9, the 18, the 4 and then 6, he would lose the essence of truth. Unless the soul merges with Shabd, he is a mere parrot, however much may be his learning. If we study the 4 Vedas, the 18 Puranas, the 9 works of grammar and the 6 systems of philosophy, but do not gain any knowledge of Surat Shabd Yoga, we will be no better off than a parrot, imitating the words it hears. The scriptures remain a string of empty words unless they lead to the reality they describe. Kabir Sahib says, reading volume after volume, men tire themselves to death, but not one becomes a real scholar. Only one who learns the small word love is truly learned. Bulle Shah says, close tight, O friend, these barren books of knowledge, not but the name of God should you acknowledge. Christ says in the Bible, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. In other words, he says, O Lord, I am very grateful to you that you have kept this great wisdom away from the worldly wise and intellectual people, and have revealed its secret only to those who are as innocent as little children. By reading scriptures and holy books, all we gain is some theoretical knowledge. The endless discussions of the philosophers are no more than a spider's web that entangles us and prevents our escape. We sometimes develop the habit of sophisticated intellectual argument. We may begin to pride ourselves on being great scholars and intellectuals and regard others as illiterate and ignorant. We may become vain and egoistic. But on the path of God realization, one must become unlettered like a child. Reading is like cleaning a bowl. If one's whole life is spent only in cleaning and nothing is put into the bowl, it is actually a waste of time. The dirty bowl of our mind must be cleansed so that we can fill it with the divine nectar. Our scriptures are records of the experiences of sages and seers, prophets and saints. They worked very hard and spent many sleepless nights in order to meet their beloved, the Supreme Lord. For our own benefit, they have described in these books the things that they saw within and the obstacles that they came across during their spiritual ascent. The books tell us of their actual experiences, but we cannot share those experiences just by reading about them. If we do not put into practice what we read in holy books and do not search within ourselves, reading them can be of little help. The object of our spiritual search is to merge our consciousness with the immanent word or divine power that resounds within all human beings.
This power is the heritage of all mankind. It is within each and every human body. It has been put there for our use, but the way to reach it is in the keeping of the saints. Guru Arjan says, "The treasure of the unstruck sound is hidden within us. The key to it has been entrusted to the saints." Elsewhere he says, "He who created this body, this house of clay, has locked it and to the Guru has entrusted the key. Without the Guru, the treasure within is never gained, even though you may try to gain it in endless ways."
Chapter 4. The Living Master. The Company of Saints. The Lord who created us has kept the treasure of the name within us, but its secret is known only to the saints. We must go to the saints and be in their company to gain the wealth of the name. Guru Amar Das says, "Without Guru, the giver, one does not attain the Lord, even if one performs innumerable good deeds. In the service of the Guru, there is bliss forever. The Guru helped me to behold the invisible Lord." Guru Arjan says, "This is what the Lord has revealed to me, that without the Guru, O Nanak, no one gains salvation. Let no one in this world be deluded. Without help from the Guru, there is no crossing the ocean of existence." Guru Ramdas says, "Listen, O seekers, hearken unto me, O brother. Boldly and with complete confidence, the Guru declares, if you seek eternal bliss for your soul, take refuge with the Sadguru." All masters place great emphasis on the value of being in the company of a master. Without association with them, they say, there is no possibility of release from the cycle of death and rebirth. Guru Arjan writes, "The Vedas, the Smritis and the holy scriptures, all these have I studied. They all proclaim the same truth. Reflect well within your mind. Without a guru, no one attains salvation." And Guru Amar Das says, "No one can gain Naam without help from the Sadguru. Such is the law the Creator has made. The Lord created a natural law that anyone who meets Him must do so through one of the saints. In this connection, Christ says in the Bible, 'Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest.' Then again He says, 'I am the way, the truth and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. If ye had known me, ye should have known my Father also. And from henceforth ye know him and have seen him.' That is to say, you can meet the Father only through me. I am the only means and the only way. If you recognize me, you have recognized the Lord and seen him." He further says that, "He that seeth me, seeth him that sent me." At another place he says, "I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Tulsi Sahib brings out the same point in his teachings. "There are in this world, O Tulsi, 5 jewels of the purest worth: association with the enlightened ones, complete self-surrender at the feet of the Sadguru, doing good to others, humility and compassion. As gold is free from rust and iron is not eaten by white ants, in the same way the Guru's disciple, whether he be good or bad, is never sent to hell." Swamiji also mentions the importance of keeping the company of saints, saying, "The human birth once lost is lost forever. In the wilderness of the 84, you will have to roam thereafter. Serve the Master to win his pleasure, and to that end, direct all your activities. Stand firm in the realization that except for the Master, you have no real friend, not a soul whom you may call your own." And again he says, "None attains him without the grace of the Master, and without Shabd, he is not obtained. Pull your soul up to the skies within, listen to the sound of the Shabd. This alone is the true practice." Kabir Sahib also speaks of the supreme importance of association with saints or true masters. "The soul whose life is spent without devotion to the Master will take birth as a bitch. From street to street she will wander, and nobody will throw her even a crumb of bread. And if a monarch dies without this true devotion, he will again return to earth, but as an ass. The potter will load him down with heavy clay, and no one will give him so much as a blade of grass to eat. The man who prides himself on his fine clothes and wastes his time in frivolous enjoyments
is bound most surely, O Kabir, for the land of the messengers of death. Kabir further says, the counting of rosary beads, the giving of alms, these are meaningless without a master, as the Vedas and Puranas confirm. Guru Ramdas writes, unfortunate are those who do not meet a Sadguru. They are under the sway of Kal. They have to take birth again and again in the round of transmigration. They are born as miserable worms living in excrement. Those who do not meet a saint are indeed most unfortunate. They always remain under the sway of Kal, the negative power. They have to undergo repeated births and deaths and endure much suffering and misery. They may even have to incarnate as worms. Those who do not seek and find a true master can never contact the name and will move according to their karmas from one body to another in the prison of this world, undergoing untold misery all the time. In fact, when they are in this world, they are really more dead than alive. Guru Amar Das says, those who serve not the Sadguru and love not Naam, do not take them to be alive. The Lord Himself has reduced them to the state of the dead. Everybody is in search of happiness and peace and tries to find them in different worldly things, people and places. But real happiness lies in the name of the word, and we can contact the name only with the help of a true saint. The name is within us and is our heritage, but without the company of a saint, we can never discover its transcendent, true and pure music. We should therefore try to find a true saint so that he may put us in touch with the word. Nothing else can ever bring us lasting peace and bliss. Bulle Shah says, without a perfect murshid, O Bulla, all your praying has been done in vain. Contact with the guide gave him true instruction. My master is Shah Inayat, he alone can ferry me across. Saints do not have to give us anything from outside. The transcendent wealth of the name is within us and has been kept there for us by the Lord. It must be found within our own selves. The saints only have to point the way and reveal the method of finding it. The power of learning, for example, is within all of us, but for the most part it lies dormant until we go to school and college. Then if we listen attentively to what the teacher says and diligently carry out the work assigned by him, the latent power of learning is awakened and we become doctors, engineers or scholars. In the case of students who fear their teachers, play truant and fail to attend classes, the power of learning stays dormant. It is the association with our teachers and our own effort to learn that develops our intellect. Take another example. We all know that milk has ghee, clarified butter in it. But if we do not know how to make ghee, we can never get ghee out of the milk. Ghee can always be obtained from milk, but it cannot be obtained without using the appropriate method. Guru Ramdas says, just as fire is in wood and can be produced with skill, so is the flame of Ram Naam, the name of God, in every human being, and can be uncovered through the Guru's wisdom. There is fire in wood, but we do not see it, nor can we make use of it. First we must rub one piece of wood against another. This produces fire which we can both see and make use of. In the same way, the light of the word is within each one of us. When we follow the directions given by the masters, we see it. Guru Ramdas explains this by giving another illustration. Within your own home, within the body, is a treasure house of rubies, gems and jewels. But the mind lost in illusion cannot find it. Just as the water diviner in a moment reveals the hidden well, so the Sadguru helps us find the treasure within. In our body, the Lord has kept the numerous treasures of the name, but our mind wanders about outside the body in doubt and delusion. So long as it does not go within and make a thorough search for the treasures, it can never find them. For example, in villages there are often old wells that have been filled in. We may even walk over them without knowing that they are there. But the water diviners through their special skill tell us where to dig and we then find the ready-made wells. The diviners do not actually dig the wells. The wells are already there and the water diviners simply tell us where to dig. Similarly, the Lord resides in the inner recesses of our heart and the way to Him lies within the human body. Saints simply show us the path and we must seek their guidance. Our mind is quick to take on the attributes of the company it keeps. It is dyed in the hue of its associations. When one has the company of saints and lovers of God, one loses interest in the show of the world and develops love for the Lord. By this means, sinners become saints, the wicked become virtuous, and the greedy become contented.
Guru Ramdas says, "The worldly man with mind confused is like a tangled skein of thread which cannot be woven into cloth. Not much of value will come from this skein. We should avoid the company of such men. If yarn is tangled, it can never be woven into cloth. Even so, the manmukh, worldly man, whose mind is entangled in the world and its sense pleasures, can never turn Godwards."
Guru Ramdas further says, "The worldly are ever hungry, day in and day out. They are tormented by desires. Stricken with the love of the world, lured on and on, they are madly chasing after Maya. Keep a distance of a million miles from such as these." A manmukh or worldly men are avaricious and ever hungry. The Lord may grant them health and wealth, family and children, honor and glory, but they still do not ask for God Himself. Their desires and cravings are innumerable. One should completely avoid the company of people of this kind who are constantly running after the illusionary pleasures of the world. Guru Ramdas says again, "O Lord, grant us the company of saints so that we may remember Thee." Saints always place great emphasis on true company, the satsang of the masters. In their company, we learn about the relationship between the soul and the Lord, and about the barriers that prevent the soul from merging into the Lord, and how those barriers can be removed. A gathering where one religion criticizes another, or where one sect schemes the downfall of another, or where people tell stories about past kings and heroes, is not considered to be satsang by the saints. Through satsang, the saints engender in us a desire to meet God. They create love for Him in our heart, and they also tell us the path and the method for meeting Him. We should not start fighting and intimidating people if they do not worship God the way we wish them to. We should tell them gently and lovingly of whatever benefit we have received by following the path, and say that if they consider it worth their while, they might also give it a trial. We should never quarrel with them. Guru Nanak says, "How to know true company? It is where Naam alone is expounded." So long as a true master who is in communion with the Lord, who reveals to us the inner path of Shabd or the Word, and who has the power to make others meet the Lord, is not present, there can be no true satsang. Guru Amar Das says, "Without the true Guru, there is no true satsang, and without Shabd, no one is ferried across." Kabir Sahib glorifies the satsang of saints in these terms: "Seek, O Kabir, the company of the enlightened ones, even if they can offer you only coarse millet to eat. Shun the company of the worldly man, even if he should offer you a banquet of the most delicious food." He further says, "A moment, half a moment, half even of that in the company of the saints is enough to burn a multitude of sins." Swamiji counsels, "Of all your close companions, not one is your true friend. Why are you asleep in the company of these thugs? Wake up and put your heart in satsang. The master will then dye you in the name beyond Kala." At another place he says, "Why do you stay in this world, O brother? What profit is there in wandering here? Make a resolve and seek him in satsang." Maulana Rum says, "One moment spent in the company of saints is far better than praying for 100 years. The Master and the Lord. If our destination lies to the east and we run to the west, we naturally get farther away from our goal. The only purpose of satsang is to create in us love for the Lord and to impress upon us that the real form of the Sadguru is the word or the name. Saints emerge from the ocean of the name and after their earthly sojourn, go back and merge into the same ocean again. They assume the human form because a human being can have only another human being as his teacher. Nobody has seen gods and goddesses, nor does anybody know the form of God. Unless a person who is like ourselves teaches us, we cannot understand anything about the Lord. Christ called saints the Word made flesh. When the Word takes a human form, that person becomes a living master. The Lord and the Word are one and the same thing. Thus Christ says in the Bible, 'I and my Father are one. The Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh
and dwelt among us. Similarly, Guru Arjan says, the devotee of the Lord, the Master, is like the Lord. Make no distinction between them because of his human form. Many are the waves that rise in the sea and then merge back water into water again. There is no difference between the Lord and his devotees. By worshipping God, they become God. The Shruti, a Hindu scripture, says, those who know Brahm become Brahm. Just as waves rise in the sea for a moment and then merge back into it again, even so the lovers of the Lord are waves of the ocean of divinity, and after finishing their mission of mercy, they merge back into the ocean. The relation of the saint with the Lord is the same as that of the waves to the sea. Every saint is a wave of the ocean of Satnam. They come into this world, and after joining our consciousness with the name, they take us with them and merge back into the same ocean. In fact, when the Lord wishes to free us from chains of birth and rebirth, he comes in the form of a true master and merges us back into himself by joining our consciousness with the Word. Christ also says, I came forth from the Father and am come into the world again. I leave the world and go to the Father. The Shabd Master and the Lord are one. There is no difference between the two. But it is only through the Master in human form that we can realize the Shabd Master and thus realize God. Kabir Sahab says, without a human form, how can God speak to us? He speaks through the screen of the body. Guru Nanak says, the Creator places himself in the Guru. He further says, without a Sadguru, no one has ever found him. None indeed can ever find him without a Sadguru. He puts himself in the Sadguru and revealing it, he proclaims it to all. Guru Ramdas says, by churning the ocean of the body, I have discovered a marvelous thing. The Guru is God and God is the Guru. Between them, O Nanak, there is no difference. By making a thorough search within the body, he says he discovered that the Shabd Master and the Lord are one and the same, and there is no difference between them. Similarly, Guru Arjan says, know the Guru and the Lord to be one. Maulana Rum says in the Diwan of Shams-e Tabrizi, that great Lord has put us out and shut himself behind the fast closed doors. Then concealed in the cloak of man, he comes to open the door. Maulana Rum states elsewhere, the light of God manifests itself in the saints, and it is from them that you will learn how to behold it. Bulle Shah also explains that God comes in the form of man and awakens the world. Kabir Sahib explains the same truth saying, the Lord and Kabir are one and the same. It is in talking and describing that they sound like two. Their duality bewilders only the man who has not yet found a true guru. Saint Namdev says the same thing. The Lord of the soul has come in a human form. See the Lord in him, says Namdev. My very life I will lay down at his feet. Only devotion to him and nothing else will go to your credit. Christ also says in the Bible, believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me. He repeats, the Father is in me and I in him. Swamiji says, Radha Swami, the Supreme Lord, descended to the world wearing the form of a man. He came as a master and awakened the souls. The Master does not entangle us in rites and rituals, but helps us to make contact with the Word or the Name. He shows us the way home that lies within our own body. Guru Nanak says, it is the true Guru, the wise one, who shows our home within this home, where reverberate the melodies five, the manifestation of Shabd. Swamiji also says, the Master shows within the home of the body, the heavenly home of the soul. He reveals the five melodies within. Saints explain that there are five higher regions within, through which the soul passes to reach Sachkhand, the true or imperishable region, the house of the Lord. Christ also says, in my Father's house are many mansions. Each region has its own sound. A true master takes our consciousness through the five regions, joins it with the five melodies or divine sounds, and leads us to the Lord himself. In reality, the word is one, but at every stage it has different and distinctive sound and a distinctive light. The word makes different sounds in different places, just like a river. A river starts from its source and ultimately flows into the sea. but it makes different sounds along the way. At the source, it has one sound. When it passes through gorges or narrow valleys with steep sides, it has another. When it is waterfall, it has different sound. When it spreads into the plains, its sound changes. Finally, when it flows into the sea, the sound is again quite different. But the river is always the same river. Similarly, there is only one creative power or word, but mystics talk about five sounds. Kabir Sahib says, "Catch hold of the word from which everything has emerged. Meditate on this word, O Sadhu." Maulana Rum says in the Diwan, "As you rise over the six lower regions and reach the seventh heaven, you will hear five different melodies." He says, "Every day the five melodies resound from door of the Most High." Khwaja Hafiz similarly affirms, "From the sixth to the seventh sky ascend, be still and with your inward ear strive to hear that heavenly harmony of which the strains are five." In the Anand Sahib from the Adi Granth we read, "Great is his good fortune who hears the five melodies within. Lucky the home of the body in which Shabd is heard resounding. Lucky the home in which the Lord reveals his mysterious power. O Lord, you have controlled the five foes and Kaal himself you have vanquished." Kabir Sahab states, "The five unstruck melodies reverberate within me and I abide ever in the Lord. O thou formless absolute one, this is how I perform thy worship." Beni Sahab says, "Here ring the pure five melodies, here blare the conches with a mighty roar." Swamiji says, "Five names you should repeat, concentrating your mind in the third eye." The true master. He alone is the true master who leads us to our true home by means of the five sounds. Swamiji says that we should search for such a master who is word incarnate and practices the word. He who gives the message of Shabd is the true master, for Shabd is the real truth. He who practices Shabd is the true master. Be as dust beneath his feet. Look not for any other marks. Care not for any other qualities. Seek instruction into the secret of the Shabd from such a master and practice it with wholehearted devotion. Christ says in the Bible that if the master is not a true one, he will fall together with his disciples. If the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. Guru Amar Das says, "The true master helps you hear Shabd. Attach yourself to Shabd and thus worship the Lord day and night." Paltu Sahib states the same truth, saying, "The sound that comes from the heavens is my Guru." We can recognize a true and perfect master by his power to join our consciousness with the Shabd or word. One who finds such a master begins to hear the transcendent sweet melody within himself. In the beginning, the sound is like that of a bell or conch. Guru Arjan refers to this when he talks about he whose bell is heard throughout the four corners of the creation. Similarly, writing about a true master, he says, "He who has found a true master will hear the unstruck melody." He further says, "O Nanak, those whose guru is a perfect one feast upon the unceasing music of Shabd." The transcendent and enchanting music which is limitless and ceaseless has been called the unstruck melody. This ever-resounding inner music is the voice of God. A true master reveals to his disciple the secret of this audible life stream and teaches him how to hear it, and ultimately to practice listening to it so attentively that he merges into it. The master is a part of the word of the Lord and makes us also a part of the Lord. Christ explains this truth when he tells his disciples that they are merged in him and he is merged in God. Therefore, they are also merged in God. He further explains, "If ye had known me, ye should have known my Father also. And from henceforth ye know him and have seen him. He that hath seen me hath seen the Father." Swamiji says, "Get the secret of Shabd from the master and then merge wholly into it." In reality, the real form of the true master is the Shabd, word or logos. He assumes the human form in order to be able to tell people the way back to the Lord. The body, both of the master and of the disciple, is perishable. It'll be left behind here to be burned or buried. The disciple's real form is the soul, which ultimately will merge into the word. Even after leaving his body, the true Master continues to watch over his disciples. Christ says in the Bible, "These things have I spoken unto you, being yet present with you. But the Comforter, Word, which is the Holy Ghost, whom the Father will send in my name, he shall teach you all things, and bring all things to your remembrance, whatsoever I have said unto you." That is to say, when I leave this mortal body, the Lord will manifest the Word in my radiant form within you, and then that radiant form will look after you and guide you. The Guru is the Word. He is a link between man and God. He is the one who takes people back to the Lord. After fulfilling his allotted task, he merges back into the Word. Likewise, the soul is also a ray of the Word, and through the grace of a true Master, it is able to return and unite itself with the Word. Guru Nanak says, "The Guru is Shabd, and the soul is its disciple." The saints of the past were doubtless true masters, but we cannot benefit from them now. We need a living master of the present day. If a patient were to say that he would like to be treated by the famous Dr. Lukman, he would not receive any treatment. He must go to a living doctor. If a Sikh were to say that his case should be decided by Maharaja Ranjit Singh, this could not be. He would have to seek justice from a living magistrate. If a woman were to wish to marry Raja Vikramaditya, her wish would remain unfulfilled. We need a living doctor, a living magistrate, and a living husband. Likewise, we need a living master. He alone can help us cross the ocean of phenomena. Christ says of John the Baptist in the Bible that he was a burning and a shining light, and ye were willing for a season to rejoice in his light. He then says very clearly about himself, "I must work the works of him that sent me, while it is a day during my lifetime. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." A true master is needed so that in the form of a man he can explain everything to us clearly. If we could do without a living master for God realization, then past saints on whom we depend need not have taken the human form. They completed their mission of mercy and went back to the Lord. A living teacher is an absolute necessity on the path. There are many books on the sciences of medicine and engineering. Libraries are full of them. But we can find no one who has become a doctor or an engineer merely by reading these books. We associate with teachers for 15 to 20 years and work hard to gain knowledge, put it into practice and get first-hand experience. Spirituality is a very involved and complex subject. Until we benefit from the experience of a real guide who is familiar with every detail of the spiritual regions, we cannot even begin to move inwards and upwards. True or real master is the Word, which is the heritage of all mankind, but we cannot catch hold of it unless we have a guide in human form to help us. Guru Ram Das says, "Bani, the Word, is the Guru, and the real form of the Guru is Bani. In the Bani is contained the nectar entire, the Guru's word the disciples accept, and through the living Guru they attain liberation." The Master is the Word, and the Word is the Master. The real nectar is in the Word. It is this Word to which the Masters constantly refer. With loving devotion and unwavering faith, the disciple accepts what the Master teaches, and the Master connects his soul with the indwelling power of the Word. There are two kinds of true Masters. The first are those who descend directly from Sachkhand and are saints from the time of their birth.
The second are those who reach Sachkhand through the grace of their Master by meditating upon the name or word, and thus become saints in their lifetime.
When we take refuge with the true Master, he does not neglect us after initiating us, but is responsible for taking us back to our true home. Guru Arjan says, "The Guru ever keeps me company." Guru Nanak says, "No one can nullify the gifts given by the Guru. Those whom he forgives are ferried across." Christ also says in the Bible, "And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand." Those who are given the name by the Master do not have to meet the angels of death and go with them. The saints grant us that name or word which no one can take away. Swamiji says, "The saint sows within the mind of the disciple the seed of Naam. Who then can have the power to destroy that seed and prevent it from sprouting?" In the Bible, Christ says with great emphasis, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away." That is to say, the sky and earth may vanish, but the word revealed by me will last forever. Guru Arjan says, "My Guru is the Lord God Himself and a source of happiness to me. He helps me practice Naam, and in my last moments, He will be my friend and refuge." Such masters come to receive their disciples at the time of death. They do not allow the angels of death to touch them. The Master is our true friend and savior, not only in this world, but also in His radiant form in the next. Guru Nanak says, "He alone, O beloved, is our friend who goes with us to the other world, and on the day of reckoning, stands by us as our surety." Similarly, Guru Arjan says, "Nanak, sever your relations with false friends and find the saint your true friend. They forsake you even while you are living, but he will not leave you even at the time of death." Most of our relations and friends leave us during our lifetime, but the masters are our real friends and do not leave us even at the time of our death. They save us from the clutches of angels of death. By coming under the protection of such masters, our entire karmic account will be settled once and for all. Guru Ram Das says, "The deed of our karmas has been torn up in the court of Dharmrai, the Lord of Justice. O Nanak, the Guru has settled the account forever." Guru Arjan says, "All miseries disappear and all poisons become harmless with the repetition of Naam. Even the records of that soul in the court of Dharmrai are destroyed." At another place he says, "When the record of all my deeds has been destroyed, what action can Dharmrai take?" Christ says in the Bible, "He that heareth my word hath everlasting life, and is passed from death unto life. And blessed are they that hear the word of God and keep it." That is to say, those who are joined to the word by a true master escape from the cycle of birth and rebirth and gain everlasting life. Such masters are rare, but they are always present in the world. In every age, they come to reveal the path to real seekers. Guru Ram Das says, "In every age, in age after age, the line of gurus continues. Throughout the aeons, the task of uniting souls with the Lord goes on." At one time, there can be more than one true saint. The true masters are not privilege of any one country, time or religion. They may appear in any country and be of any religion. Guru Nanak says, "Blessed are your saints in every age, O God, for they sing your praises sweetened with your love. They are never a burden on society or on their nation. They earn their own living and take no payment for their services. Guru Nanak earned his living by farming at Kartarpur and with his earnings took care of his family and children. He received no payment for serving his disciples." Guru Nanak says, "If a saint or a seer goes begging, do not go near him or fall at his feet. If he earns his own living and gives part of it away, says Nanak, he alone knows the way." If a saint begs from his disciples, he is not a true master. He should be avoided. He does not deserve respect or esteem. But the saint who earns his own living, gives free service to the Sangat and knows the path, is the kind of master that one must find. Christ says in the Bible, "Freely ye have received, freely give." Kabir Sahab remained a weaver throughout his life, even though he had disciples such as King of Bukhara, who could have provided him with every comfort. He says, "It is for the disciple to offer himself body and soul as a sacrifice at the Guru's feet, but the true master will not touch a single penny that is offered to him. For my own self, I would rather die than beg, but I am not ashamed to accept offerings for the welfare of others." The saints use all that may be given to them for the good of the world, so that honestly earned money is put to proper use. They never hold out their hands to ask for anything for their own use. Swamiji says, "The master does not wish to receive money from you. He is rich enough with the wealth of devotion. The money he asks you to give will earn spiritual merit for you, for he will give it in charity on your behalf to those who are suffering from hunger and thirst." Guru Ravidas was a cobbler. Raja Pipa, a Rajput king, and Meera Bai, the princess of Marwar, were among his disciples. In the biography of Mirabai, it is said that she could not bear it when her relatives once taunted her, saying that she lived in a palace while her master was a cobbler. She took a large diamond to her master and begged him, "Please sell this diamond, buy a comfortable house, and live a life of honor and ease." Saint Ravidas replied, "My daughter, I have no need for your diamond. I already have wealth so great that it could not possibly be calculated." The true masters set an example of how we must devote ourselves to the Lord while living in this world and discharging our obligations. They do not say that you should leave your home and family and go to the forests or mountain caves. By going to such places, we do not increase our longing and love for the Lord, since the same desires and cravings that we now have will also be with us there. The moment we return and face the world, the mind will again make us dance to its tune. Our condition actually becomes even worse. What do we need in this world? We need food to fill our stomach, clothing to cover our body, and a roof over our head to protect us from bad weather. We can increase these wants or reduce them, but wherever we go, these wants will follow us. Therefore, going to a forest or a mountain cave makes no difference at all. Instead of white robes, we may wear orange ones, but whatever their color, clothes we must wear. If we give up eating food in our own home, we will have to beg for it from others because we still need food. If we leave the comfort of our own home, we will still have to find shelter in caves or ashrams because we will still need to have a roof over our head. We are not able to give up any of these things, clothing, food, and shelter. If we do give them up, we become a burden on society and have to think up many different ways to get them. The saints tell us that we should live bravely and valiantly in the world. We should not be caught in the trap of the world and its objects. Guru Nanak says, "As the lotus flower lives in water, but still it is not wet. As the duck keeps its wings dry, so should man live in this world, attaching his spirit to Shabd. In this way, O Nanak, he can cross the ocean of phenomena." The lotus flower always remains above the surface, although its roots are in the mud. The duck may be in water all day long, but it is able to fly away with its wings dry. We should live in the world in the same way by connecting our soul with the sound current. If a bee sits on the rim of a cup filled with honey, it can enjoy the sweet taste of honey and can also fly away safely. But if it tries to sit inside the cup, it'll be drowned in the honey it is seeking. Thus, we must live on the edge of the world as a spectator and not allow ourselves to be drowned in its sense pleasures. A newly wedded girl staying in the home of her parents serves her parents, plays with her friends and companions, and carries out all her household duties. Yet her mind is always thinking of her husband and her love for him. This is how we should live in this world. While working out our karmic credits and debits, our attention should always be focused on our love and devotion for our master. The saints therefore advise us to live in our own home and earn our own living, but also remember the Lord, search for a true master, get the secret of the name from him, and practice it wholeheartedly. Guru Amar Das says, "Seek, O brothers, the perfect Gurmukh. He will teach you how to give true devotion to Naam." At another place he says, "Through the true Shabd you will attain true honor. Without Naam no one gains liberation. Without a true Guru no one finds Naam. Such is the design ordained by the Lord himself." It is God's own design or law that no one will gain salvation except through a true master. In fact, we can never know the way to worship the Lord without guidance from a true master. Christ speaks of this same truth when he says, "I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." To be born again means to have one's consciousness joined to Shabd through initiation by a true master. This only will enable the soul ultimately to become one with the Lord. Speaking of those who do not have a true master, Kabir Sahib says, "What can the disciple do whose guru is blind? With the blind leading the blind, both will fall into the well." Similarly, Guru Amar Das says, "If the guru is blind, the disciples will also commit blind deeds." And Guru Nanak says, "Disciples whose guru is blind have no place of refuge. Without a Sadguru, they find not Naam. Without Naam, what will they gain?" Christ also says, Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. That is to say, contact with the word purges one of all sins.
Chapter 5. Devotion to the Word.
True Worship. The Lord is all-powerful, and no one can oppose or change His divine will. The Lord approves of one form of worship alone, and that is devotion to the name. Guru Amar Das says, without Naam there can be no true worship. The whole world is in delusion. By getting entangled in futile illusions, worldly people continue to roam one lifetime after another, from one cell to another in the prison house of transmigration. Other than union with the name, there is no way out. Guru Nanak says, he who ignores the path of Naam and goes some other way will bitterly repent his choice when the hour of death arrives. If we do not follow the path of Naam Bhakti, devotion to the name, but follow other paths, we are bound to repent at the time of death for foolishly wasting our time. Guru Amar Das further says, without Naam there is no admittance to the Lord's court. You will be harassed by the messengers of death. Unless we practice listening to the inner music of the name or word, we cannot enter the kingdom of God. Those who do not follow this path will have to submit to tortures by the angels of death. Swamiji says, in no uncertain words the Master urges you, O brother, to attach yourself to the unstruck melody, for there is no way other than that of Shabd. Without the Shabd, there is no liberation from the vessel of the body. This is the only means of redemption, the only way of escape from the veil of sorrow of this world. There is no other way. We should therefore use this rare opportunity of having the human body to rise above both mind and matter and merge in the divine. Penances and austerities, worship and recitals of holy books, almsgiving and charities, all have helpful effects. But to enjoy their fruit, we must be born again. To reap their harvest, we must continue to stay in the cycle of births and deaths. As has been said before, we may return as kings or as very wealthy people. We may rule over vast dominions. We may even go to some of the heavens and paradises. But after exhausting our good karmas, we have again to return to the earth plane. Penance leads to power and power to hell. We rid ourselves of iron chains only to replace them with chains of gold. From C-class prisoners we may become A-class, but prisoners we remain all the same. Deeds, good or bad, keep us tied to the world of illusion. But devotion to the elixir of immortality, which is the name, gives us freedom from this world forever. Guru Nanak says that the truth is above all, its practice is superior to all other practices. The spiritual value of Naam Bhakti, devotion to the word, far exceeds that of any other religious practice. Orthodox forms of worship keep us confined to the domain of Kal, the negative power. But devotion to the name takes us beyond the sphere of matter and mind. One can rise above the realm of matter and mind only with the aid of a power which comes from above and beyond this realm. The sound current, Naam, Shabd, word or logos, comes from Sachkhand, the fifth spiritual region, while Kal is in Trikuti, the second spiritual region. By catching hold of the divine music of the name, we are able to go beyond the domain of Kal. Swamiji says, earn, O friend, with earnest effort the boundless wealth of Shabd. Through Shabd achieve a victory over Kal. See the abode of Shabd within, through Shabd itself behold the beloved. Shabd will erase the impressions of karmas, and Shabd will enable you to merge with Shabd. Without Shabd, all knowledge is false. Without Shabd, all contemplation is hollow. O ignorant man, do not let go of Shabd, so declares Radha Swami, the Lord. Guru Nanak says, I have looked at spiritual practices, trying and testing them all. Naam is without compare. The saints have tested many different spiritual practices or forms of worship, but they have found that none can compare with Naam Bhakti. Guru Nanak further explains by giving a simile. The parrot of the soul, in love with the cage of the body, speaks in the language of the earth. If the parrot pecks at truth and drinks the nectar within, it will fly out of the cage once and for all. Our soul is compared to a parrot and our body to a cage. Just as a parrot that loves his cage makes different sounds in it, even so when our soul is in love with the body
At one time it laughs, at another time weeps, at one time it goes through pain, at another time through pleasure. But if it gives up its love for the body and tastes the nectar of the name, it can leave its cage forever and become free. Guru Arjan explains, countless religious practices performed in endless ways, all these will be of no avail. Whatever you may do will drag you deeper into the net of karma. Seeds sown at the wrong season will not bear fruit, but will die out and cause the farmer to lose even his capital. In this iron age, listening to the celestial music is the highest form of worship. Through the Gurmukh, one meditates on it in contemplation within. He himself attains salvation and helps his family do the same. To the domain of the Lord within, he goes with honor, made worthy through the practice of Naam. Other than devotion to the name, any religious practices we do to try to gain salvation will only increase our attachment to this world. If we sow seed at the wrong time of the year, we will never reap a good crop. No matter how carefully we plow the land, no matter how much fertilizer we use or how much we water the land, instead we will lose our seed, our effort and the money we spend for fertilizer and other things. Similarly, in this iron age, the only seed that will really give us salvation is devotion to the name, and we can get this seed only from a true master. Swamiji says, in Kali Yuga, the iron age, no deeds or religious practices are of any help. There is no way other than that of Naam, without which salvation remains a dream. Guru Amar Das says, in Kali Yuga, the true ship is Naam. It is the true master alone who can take you across the ocean of this world in the ship of Naam. In the Iron Age, if there is any deed or practice that is the best of all, it is Naam Bhakti. Guru Amar Das makes this point very clear when he says, understand the law of the present age, O brother. Through the true Guru this knowledge is attained. Naam will befriend you in this world and in the next. The four ages, golden, silver, copper and iron, follow each other time after time. Each age has its own characteristic features, and humanity must adapt itself to these changing conditions. Truth is infinite and eternal, but the mind of a human being is finite. In each age we have to discover truth anew. The world began with Satyuga, the golden age. It was an age where the span of human life was very long, man's attention was not scattered, he had a strong body and enjoyed good health. Only a little effort was required to concentrate the mind. The strongest force in the world was truth, and it was not difficult to preach or practice it. As the ages went by, however, our span of life became shorter, our health became poorer, and our attention became more and more scattered, so that it became increasingly difficult to concentrate the mind. Our desires became stronger and more materialistic. The world of the senses progressively dominated our thoughts. In short, the methods that were used in the golden age to return to the Lord cannot be of any help to us in the present iron age. Today, if someone lives for 60 or 70 years, they are considered quite fortunate. Our health is far less robust than in the golden age. A person of the present day is fortunate if he can sit in meditation for as long as an hour or so without changing posture. Our thoughts are so scattered that our mind cannot remain still and concentrated even for 5 minutes. The saints say that if you wish to live in happiness and peace in this iron age and go back to meet the Lord, you must practice devotion to the divine melody, the unstruck music, the audible life stream, which is always resounding within each one of us. This alone can lead us to salvation, take us out of the cycle of births and deaths, merge the drop of the soul into the ocean of the Lord, and thus make it one with the ocean. In this age, saints have strongly urged the practice of Naam Bhakti, or listening to the inner music of the Shabd, Naam, Word or Logos. Guru Amar Das says, everyone worships God, but the Manmukh knows not the way. If he were to merge in Shabd, his mind would become pure. This is the worship accepted by the Lord. All of us try to worship God in the way that we think to be best, for the inclination of the soul is always towards its source. No doubt we do search for God, but when we search, we follow the dictates of our mind. Such worship can never free us from the cycle of births and deaths and can never take us to our true home. Our true home is Satchkhand, the fifth spiritual region, while the domain of the mind extends only up to the second spiritual region. It is only through devotion to the music of the spheres, the word or the name, that our mind can become pure and reach its own source, thus making it possible for the soul to return to the Lord. Not every form of worship leads to God realization. Swamiji says, "This human body with which the Lord has blessed you is a symbol of divine grace. Use it for true worship of the Lord so that your karmas will be burned and your soul will be made pure." The human body is a priceless gift. We have obtained it through the Lord's grace. While living in it, we must practice devotion to the name so that all our karmic accounts may be burned. Guru Amar Das explains, "All people worship the Lord, but they do not know the proper way to do so. The spirit, instead of being purified, is covered more and more with dirt. We do not know the real method of worship designed by the Lord for our use. By following the wrong path, we actually make our load of karmas even heavier. Christ says, 'Ye worship, ye know not what.'" Swamiji also speaks about this subject, saying, "In false religions is the world entangled, and no one tries to learn the practice of Naam, which takes you safely through this world. The one who is too lazy to churn milk and churns water, what butter will he obtain? Can I possibly recount the misfortunes of worldly people? They are caught in the snares of the world and always keep on wandering without work that brings a real reward. The work of meditating on Shabd, that is resounding in the inner selves, to this task they will not devote themselves. We do not know how to practice the real or true worship, which is devotion to the name of the word and listening to its music within ourselves. Instead, we perform traditional rituals, which is like eating the shells of nuts and throwing away the kernels. If we churn water, we can never get butter. It is only when milk is churned that butter is obtained." Swamiji advises us to endeavor to join our mind with the sound current, for this is the philosopher's stone that makes the mind pure and transmutes its present base metal into gold. Guru Amar Das says, "Those who forget the Shabd have no place nor shelter. They wander lost in illusion like a crow in an empty house. They lose both this world and the next, passing from sorrow to sorrow. Those who do not search for the word or logos have no place either here or beyond. Just as a crow may constantly fly about in an empty house but find no food, even so, we wander here and there in the vast prison of the cycle of death and rebirth, but find no real relief or rest anywhere. Sadly enough, we lose both this world and the next." Christ, when speaking of the importance of the word, says that the people who turn their back on it and speak ill of it cannot be pardoned either in this world or in the next. "Whosoever speaketh against the Holy Ghost, it shall not be forgiven him, neither in this world, neither in the world to come." The combination of key letters that enables one to open the safe or the prison of the body is the raising of the body consciousness, so that it hears and unites with the word, the voice of God. This is the ancient wisdom which all messengers of God come to teach in this world. This law is eternal and cannot be changed or modified. It is the same today as yesterday and forever. This act is real or true worship. It is all-embracing and comprehensive. The benefits of rituals and penances, worship and charity, all are included in the great benefit derived from devotion to the sound current. When one is engaged in the repetition of the five holy names, what better repetition can there be? When we surrender ourselves completely to His will, what penance can be superior? When we are absorbed in listening to the unstruck music within, what other music can compare with it? When we constantly contemplate within upon the form of the Master and have His radiant form with us wherever we go, what other form of worship can be better? When we drink the divine nectar of the Shabd, Naam, word or logos and turn away completely from the pleasures of the world, what other kind of renunciation and detachment can be as great? Whether it be worshipping in temples and mosques, running away to mountain caves and forests, going on pilgrimages and bathing in sacred rivers, giving alms and charity or reciting holy books and enduring penances, none of this can be reconciled with true worship. True worship springs from contact with the Word or Holy Spirit that resounds within us. It is this true form of worship on which God puts the seal of His approval. It is this true worship that brings honor in His court. There is no need to give up one's home, family, and children. While still with them, we should concentrate our attention on the sweet melody that is always resounding within us. This is the only way to escape from the karmic web. Only this form of devotion breaks all our karmic ties with this world and frees us from the crushing load of recurring births and deaths. Only this form of worship enables us to transcend the regions of mind and matter, to untie the knot that binds the mind and soul together, to remove the coverings of the three attributes, harmony, activity, and inertia, that enslave the soul, to recognize our inner self, and ultimately to realize God. Saints therefore urge us to understand and practice this form of worship and make no show of the grace that we may receive within. The more carefully and silently we preserve this wealth, the greater will be the measure of its flow from Him. It should not be wasted in performing miracles or winning short-lived fame. His grace is an elixir that will give life everlasting, provided that it is not allowed to flow out. It is the most rare and valuable jewel that must be kept in a locked treasure chest. Kabir Sahib says, "When you have found the jewel of the name, keep it tied up most safely in your bundle. No one, alas, appreciates its worth, and there is no one who desires to buy it. The world, O Kabir, is ignorant of its great value." After obtaining the priceless wealth of the name, keep it so securely that no one will know about it. In this wide world, there is no one deserving of it. There is no one who realizes its worth. There is no one who wishes to buy it. All the worldly people are in the market for sons and daughters, wealth and possessions, honor and glory. No one is prepared to pay the price asked for the jewel of the name, which is to give oneself to the Lord and to surrender oneself completely to His will. Kabir Sahib says further, "All the elixirs of immortality have I tried, but none of them compares with the name. If only a tiny particle of it is absorbed, the whole of one's being is transmuted into gold. We have known and tried all kinds of alchemy, but none of them equals the alchemy of the name. If only a particle of it is absorbed, one's whole being will turn into gold. In other words, the purpose of human birth will be achieved and fulfilled." Similarly, Guru Amar Das says, "Those who know its worth keep this treasure carefully. It is through the Guru they obtain this awareness. Priceless indeed is the wealth of Naam, obtained from a Gurmukh by the rare few." Those who realize the great value of the name guard it very carefully. The ability to know its value, however, is obtained only in the company of saints. If we were to discover a rare diamond, how safe we would keep it. We would wrap it in downy cotton and place it in an iron chest, keeping the key of the chest next to our heart. We would say nothing about it even to our family and children, for fear that they would divulge the secret and we would lose the diamond. This is the care that we would take of a worldly thing of which the price can be known and fixed. You can therefore well imagine how much solicitude and watchfulness are needed in the case of priceless wealth of the name, the worth of which cannot be calculated, and by the possession of which we become God. Swamiji says, "Love the Master, have faith in Him, assimilate the alchemy of Naam within." Just as Rasayan, a panacea, spreads through every part of the body and removes all its ills, even so the name enters every pore. We should devote ourselves to the name of the Word, however, only for the purpose of God realization and not for the purpose of getting children, wealth or power. The Lord's grace will be showered on us in proportion to the intensity of our love for Him. Swamiji describes this love and longing by giving examples from everyday life. Just as the rainbird yearns for drops of rain and constantly cries for them, even so must the devotee long for the Lord. A devotee's desire for God is like a miser's craving for wealth. He will yearn for God as a drowning man gasps for breath. The devotee remembers God in the same way that a lover remembers his loved one. She is never out of his mind, even for a moment. The devotee fixes his mind on God just as a cow always remembers its calf, even while it is grazing in the field. He merges his thoughts in the remembrance of the Lord just as a deer gives all its attention to listening to the music of a flute. It is so intent on listening to the music that it never withdraws its mind from it, even though its absorption in the music may lead to its capture. The devotee develops a love for the Lord which is similar to the love of the moth for brilliant light.
He has the same love for the Lord as a fish has for water. The fish cannot bear a moment's separation from water, and when taken out of the water, it'll die.
Such love is true worship. We must not love the Lord because we are afraid of losing money in our business, or because we fear the loss of wealth, possessions, honor, or glory. This is an inferior kind of devotion to the Lord. We should be devoted to the Lord because of our true love for Him. Worshipping the Lord in order to gain possession of worldly objects is no better than the worship of snakes as it is practiced in some parts of our country. People do not worship snakes because they have love for them, but because they are afraid of them. The true basis of religion is love, not fear. We should therefore develop true love for the Lord in our hearts. Tulsi Sahab says, "Cleanse the heart's chamber for the Beloved to come. Drive out all thoughts of others if you would seat Him there." Love for the world. Our heart is always longing for worldly objects, and yet at the same time we wish to meet the Lord. How can these two kinds of desire live together? Love for the world and love for God do not go together. Where one is, the other is not. There is only one mind and it can turn either towards the world or towards God. It cannot do both. If one of our close and dear relatives goes a long way away from us, we spend sleepless nights in remembering him. We may weep because of the pain of separation. But have we ever shed a single tear for the Lord? Have we ever stayed awake all night in remembering him? A mother may leave her child in the care of a nursemaid who looks after the child very lovingly. She tries to keep him happy in many different ways. She tells him fascinating stories. She gives him toys to play with. She offers him sweets to keep him satisfied and contented. But a moment comes when nothing seems to satisfy the child and he begins to cry. He wants his mother and nobody else. Nothing else will do. At such a moment, the mother herself can no longer bear the separation. She comes running to the child and puts him in her lap. Similarly, as long as we are completely absorbed in love for the creation and have forgotten the Creator, we can never get His attention. It is only when we forget the creation and begin to really long for the Creator that we win His love and grace. He then lifts us up so that we can merge into Him. Guru Amar Das says, "A customer for God alone obtains the jewel through meditation. Opening the inner eye, he beholds the treasure of liberation." Paltu Sahab says, "On every side you hear people speaking of the name, but the name is not so easy to attain, because the path of the name is different. Only he who has killed his desires can attain it. It is not as easy to get the wealth of the name as many people think. Only those can have it who drive all desires out of their mind and fill every pore of their body with intense love." Tulsi Sahab says, "The heart is filled with many strong desires and avarice is all the time increasing. Where then is any room for seating the Lord within?" Our mind is constantly filled with different kinds of desires and cravings. We barely satisfy one desire when another springs up. When a desire is not fulfilled according to our wishes, it becomes the cause of unhappiness or frustration. When our mind is constantly occupied in this manner, it cannot receive the Lord. Guru Nanak says, "God, the giver, never tires of giving, even though we may tire of receiving His gifts through countless ages." The Lord is the supreme giver. He never tires of bestowing His gifts and granting our desires. But we mortals tire of receiving them. If we desire anything strongly, we must take birth to fulfill this desire. If we again desire something very much, we come back again. Thus we continue to return to this world over and over again. But when we finally become dissatisfied with worldly desires and ask for the Lord Himself, He grants us this desire also, and takes us to himself. There is a proverb, like mountains are desires and death is at our heels. Our worldly desires and cravings are truly innumerable. They are, so to say, even higher than the Himalayas. It might not be possible to fulfill all of them, even if the Lord gave us a life of several thousand years. But the fact is that death may come at any time and put an end to our worldly plans. Swamiji says, the lure of the world deludes all men and no one can escape from Kal. The whole world is burning in the blaze of desires. All creatures are tormented in this inferno. No way of escape can be seen. Everyone will burn in the fires of hell. Day and night they will be consumed by the fire, and countless times they will suffer transmigration. Thus will they wander about in different bodies without discovering the cure for their disease. How can I put in words the suffering they undergo? Their misery is indescribable. Our involvement with the things of the world is so intense and our desires are so strong that we even forget that someday we must die. Whoever is born must die. But under the influence of our wish for worldly possessions, we do so many things and create so many desires that it is not easy to satisfy them. The result is that we are constantly burning in the fire of our desires, not only in this life, but also after it in the fires of hell. This is not all. The force of our desires brings us back again and again to the cycle of death and rebirth. The pain and suffering that is our fate in these lives defies description. Saints therefore tell us that we should completely surrender to the will of the Lord and live happily within His commandments. The mind should not create any new desires or cravings, and whatever the Lord has granted us should be accepted with contentment. Saint Namdev says, if thou makest me a ruler over men, it shall be to thy glory alone. And if it be thy will to make me a beggar, it will make no difference at all to me. Guru Arjan also says, seat me on a throne and I will still be your slave. Make me a poor lowly grass cutter and I will not complain. O Lord, he says, even if you make me a ruler over vast dominions, I will honor and glorify you and I will serve you with devotion. And if you choose to make me a beggar, I will still go to no other door but yours. Our soul has no place of refuge other than the Lord. We should consider very carefully the fact that our mind creates desires and cravings, and that we then expect God to fulfill these desires. We never try to tell the mind that it should act according to the will of the Lord, that it should adapt itself to His commands. Rather, we ask the Lord to carry out the wishes of our mind. Swamiji says, in self-surrender to the Master's will and utterly contented with your lot, remember the Master always, friend. Whatever he may do, consider it to be of truest benefit to you and always treasure in your heart whatever word he utters. Guru Amar Das says, true devotion is that which is pleasing to the Lord, and the devotion that pleases him is submission to his will. Saints alone know how to worship the Lord because they live in his will and devote themselves to his worship. Then he says, by resigning to his will one attains perfect happiness, and Naam befriends one at the hour of death. Complete surrender to Him brings peace and bliss, and ultimately the Lord helps us. Christ also says the same thing, because I seek not mine own will, but the will of the Father which hath sent me. He further says, the Son can do nothing of Himself, but what He seeth the Father do. Kabir Sahib asks, who can be a greater king than a person who has no wants or desires, who has completely surrendered himself to the Lord, and who is happy in whatever way the Lord may keep him. Among the Muslims, there are two kinds of faqirs or holy men. The first kind is known as Ahle Dua, men of prayer, and the second kind as Ahle Raza, men of surrender to his will. The second kind is far superior to the first. We should therefore practice devotion to the name by surrendering ourselves completely to his will. The purpose of life. According to the sages of ancient India, when the Lord made the creation, He divided it into 84 lakh categories of life forms, which fall into the following broad divisions: the plant kingdom, insects and reptiles, birds, creatures living in the water, quadrupeds, human and ethereal beings, gods, goddesses, ghosts, etc. We are all prisoners in the vast prison of this world because of our karmas. We can escape from it only when our soul realizes the Lord. The gift of human life has been granted to us to enable us to escape from the cycle of recurring births and deaths. It is only in the human form that one has the unique distinction and honor of meeting the Lord. Guru Arjan says, "The Lord created the 84 lakh categories of life forms and He made man the highest. Whosoever falls from this rung of the ladder will suffer pain and misery as he comes and goes in the cycle of births and deaths. Life as a human being is the top rung of the ladder. If we try hard when we have the human body, we can step off the ladder and onto the roof. But if we slip, we will fall headlong into the prison of this world again." Guru Arjan says, "Many lives have I had as insects and worms, and many lives as elephants and fish and deer. In many lives I have been a snake or a bird, and then again I have been a tree for lives unnumbered. After countless ages I have been graced with this human life, and now it is high time to find the Lord." For endless ages we have been moving from one form of life to another. We have been plants and vegetables, insects and reptiles, fish and other water creatures, birds and animals. After a long, long time, we now have the human form, and all of us should take advantage of this human body to start on the path that leads to God realization. Maulana Rum says, "From minerals I became a plant, and then to a higher form did go. 400,000 lives have I passed, and each was better than the last. It is only after many ages that one gets the human form. If once you slip, you never know when you will get it again." It is for this reason that the sages and seers of India call the human body Nar Narayani Deh, the body which God has made, in which He Himself dwells, and in which alone He can be met. Muslim saints have called it Ashraf al-Makhlukat, the top of the creation. Jewish holy men say that God made man in His own image. Kabir Sahab says, "Rare is the human birth, one does not get it every time, even as the fruit that ripens and falls to the ground cannot be reattached to the branch again." Swamiji says, "You have got a human body at last, now do something for yourself. Do not get involved in this world, take it as a night's dream no more. The body and the home all are false. Why be consumed in illusion?" The Lord has granted us the human form so that we may do our real work. Our real work is to labor to return to our true home. This is true devotion to the Lord. This world is like an immense dream. Actually, it has no permanent reality, substance or existence. We should not forget that all our friends and relations, our wealth and possessions, our honor and glory are transient and fleeting. Even our body is fragile and short-lived. It'll soon decay. Neither the body nor anything else will accompany us when we leave this world. The saints therefore say with great emphasis that we should not fail to make the best use of this wonderful opportunity of having a human body. Family and children, eating and drinking, we have had in all our lives. The one thing that we did not have was the opportunity to practice devotion to the Lord. This is the sole purpose of human life. This is our true work. When we are born as human beings, we completely forget the purpose of life. We get so absorbed in enjoying the pleasures of the senses and devotion to our caste, creed and country that we have no time to think of anything else. Eat, drink and be merry while you are here, people say, for who knows anything about the next life. This attitude makes us busy ourselves with the world and its attractions, with the result that we quite forget about the inevitability of death. This is the case even when we see our companions departing one by one, never to return. We see them go empty-handed, leaving everything of the world behind. We seem to think, however, that death is for others and not for us. Guru Nanak describes our condition as follows. "Running about after worldly affairs, you have become bound to the creation. You have not realized truth. You fool, you are a slave of the mind. You ignore that you are subject to life and death." We are busy all day long working to get money, but we never pause to think about the main purpose of human life, the purpose for which God sent us here. Our own house is on fire, but we are busy trying to extinguish fires in the houses of others. Our own house is being robbed, but we are busy guarding the house of others. We can barely carry our own heavy load, yet we serve as beasts of burden for others. Not only do we deceive ourselves, but we also deceive the world. How very foolish and ignorant we are. Swamiji says, how shall I describe the doings of Kal, who rides with might over all? He entraps and misleads all creatures. Alas, no one fears death or Yama. Kabir Sahib, speaking of the same subject, says, what did you bring with you when you were born? What will you take with you when you die? When you came to this world, your fists were clenched. When you leave, your hands will be empty. This body is like a paper bag which will dissolve in a few drops of rain.
Listen, O saints, to the words of Kabir. Without the gift of the name, you will repent most bitterly.
We come into this world empty-handed, and empty-handed we depart. No one has come into this world bringing anything with him, nor can anyone leave it taking anything with him at the time of his departure. Our body is like a paper bag that a few drops of water can destroy, and at the time of death our body will be burned or buried. Muhammad Ghaznavi invaded India 17 times and carried back to Ghazni a huge amount of precious stones, gold and silver. His army brought bloodshed and destruction wherever they went, leaving behind countless widows and orphans. When the time of his death drew near, he ordered his court officials to put all the booty he had brought from India on exhibition in a hall in his palace. When this was done and he was carried slowly around the hall in his bed, he sighed deeply and with tears streaming down his cheeks, he exclaimed, nothing of this wealth which I committed endless cruelties and atrocities to gain will go with me now. After my death, please let my empty hands be shown to my people so they may learn a lesson from them. Christ says in the Bible, labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, for him hath God the Father sealed. That is to say, instead of spending all our time trying to amass wealth and things of the world, we should work to gather the priceless wealth of the name or the word which never perishes. The treasure of the word that I will give you, says Christ, is indestructible and everlasting, for I give it to you from the Lord and not from myself. Swamiji says, after endless wandering, you obtained the human form, but mind and senses united and destroyed you. All the attachments that we have with the world are a result of the fact that we are in a material body. When we are in such a body, friends and relatives, wealth and possessions, castes and countries, all seem to be our own. At least we try to make them our own. The moment we depart from the body, we become complete strangers to all of these worldly attachments. As long as we are in the body, therefore, we should make it do our real work. We must meditate upon God. Swamiji says, come, my friend, to your true home. Why live in an alien land? Attend now to your own work. Do not get caught up in others' tasks. Remember the Master's name as you proceed through life. It is the only wealth worth securing. All the colors of the world are sullied. Be cleansed of them, I implore you. Just study history and you will see that all great and famous kings and rulers, brave warriors and conquerors, ruthless dictators and despots, whose very name gave rise to terror in the land, are now no more. Dust they were, and to dust they returned. We look upon their graves with scorn. There is no doubt that we will meet the same fate. Today we trample their bones under our feet, but the time will soon come when others will trample upon our bones. At the time of their cremation, their ashes are blown by the wind into our eyes. At no distant date, our own ashes will be blown into other people's eyes. Saints awaken us from a long, deep sleep. They say that we should always remember that the time will come when nothing of this world will be our own, when no one will come to our help, when we will be left alone and the bird of life will have flown away. Then all our friends and relatives will be left behind. They will not even know when or from where the angels of death have come down upon us or where they will take us. There is little that they will be able to do except weep. Our relatives and friends, our mansions and possessions, our honor and glory all desert us when the angels of death take us away. We are bound to each other by karmic strings. We come here to settle our karmic debits and credits. We come to this world as parents and children, as friends and relatives. But as soon as our karmic accounts for this life are settled, we depart, each going his own way. This world is like an inn in which we all gather together for the night, but at daybreak, we all go our different ways. We are like birds that take shelter together in a tree in the evening, but with the first light of dawn, each flies off in its own way. Just as the platform of a railway station is crowded with people before a train leaves, but is deserted after its departure, even so is our family life and all our other worldly activities. They all come to an end when we depart. Again, the world is like the stage of a theatre on which each actor plays his own role and then makes his exit. During the play, there is a king, a queen, and a villain. But as soon as their allotted role is over, they leave the stage and there is neither king nor queen nor villain. All of us come into this world to settle our karmic accounts, and as soon as they are liquidated, our ties with the world are broken. When we die, our relatives are sad, but the new family into which we are born rejoices at our arrival. If we have forgotten all the relatives of our many past lives, how can we ever remember for all time our present family, for whom we work so hard and whom we love so much? Guru Nanak says, "Father, mother, all that we own, even the body itself, are stricken with the disease of death, and all our kith and kin so dear, they too will be struck down by death." Our father and mother have to depart from this world and leave us behind, and everything that we see around us in this world will remain behind us when we depart. Nothing will go with us. All our relatives and even our body, of which we take such good care, will not go with us beyond. Swamiji says, "Wife and son and grandson and the wealth you possess, none of these will help. The double flow of breath continues unbroken. One day this hide will be empty. Remember, this body is like the water carrier's leather bag. The water of breath is continuously flowing out." None of our relatives can be of any real help at the time of our death. Regardless of how full of water a tank may be, if you attach a pipe and open the valve, the tank will empty. Similarly, our body is a reservoir of breaths. As long as we breathe, we rush around in the world doing things for one another. What do people not do for the sake of filling their stomach? But we completely forget the time when this reservoir of breaths is going to be empty. At our death, people will send telegrams and make telephone calls, and relatives will gather together and consign this body, which was loved so much, either to fire or to earth. Swamiji explains this with a beautiful example. As long as a hide is filled with air, it floats on the surface of the river and people can cross the river with its help. But as soon as the air runs out, it sinks to the bottom of the river, and whoever is then clinging to it will sink to the bottom too. As long as there is breath in our body, we go on doing our worldly work and people depend on us for passing their life. But when all the air comes out of the hide, that is,
when our body has no more life in it, then all the people who were depending on this body begin to weep and wail in panic.
Swamiji points out that family and friends are all selfish. Without wealth, none of them will come near you. We become so involved, so attached to family, relations and friends, that we completely forget the Lord. Saints have only one purpose in giving these examples: to make us aware of death and to urge us to complete our spiritual journey beforehand so that we may reach our true home. Humility. Saints say we should search for God within our body. Instead of taking this advice, we let ourselves be deluded by our pride and egotism. Just think for a moment. While we are in this body, what are we proud of? Is it our youth? Have we not seen old age creeping up on people? Have we not seen the pitiful condition of patients in hospitals? Is it our wealth? Have we not seen rich people losing all their money? Is it power and authority or honor and glory? Have we not seen powerful and influential leaders forced to face the hangman's noose or being shot by an assassin's bullet? In the space of a moment, monarchies may be overthrown and their monarchs may end their lives in prison, or be sentenced to be shot dead. What then are we proud of? Kabir Sahib says, "The burning wood says to the blacksmith, even though you are burning me in your forge today, do not forget that there will come a day when I shall burn your fine body to ashes." To the potter the clay says, "It matters not if you today are kneading and crushing me with your heavy feet, for the day will surely come when I shall tread on you and trample on your body." The blacksmith burns wood in his forge to heat horseshoes. The wood warns him that the day is not far off when it will burn him on the cremation pyre. The potter kneads the clay to make earthen jars and pots. The clay warns him that before very long it will make him a part of itself when he is buried in a grave. Similarly, Swamiji says, "O man, what are you so proud of? Your body will turn to dust and you will return to the cycle of birth and rebirth." The saints therefore advise us to be meek and humble. The more humble and modest we are, the greater will be our devotion to the Lord and the greater will be His grace. Christ also speaks of humility and meekness in the Bible, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." He again says, "Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." Swamiji similarly states, "Implant meekness and humility in your mind and save yourself from lust and anger." Likewise, Guru Arjan says, "My deeds are all wretched. I have taken refuge with you, O Nanak, save me." Saints who are the highest among men are always meek and humble. Humility is their distinctive quality. They approach the door of the Lord as beggars. Guru Nanak in deep humility calls himself the lowest of the low, the slave of his slaves. Even after they have attained the highest possible degree of spirituality and become the Lord himself, they still maintain their humility.
We should draw inspiration from the lives of the saints.
But even when we get a little power in our hands, we are apt to become proud and to look down with disdain on other human beings. Kabir Sahib says, "I went out in search of an evil man, but could not find one. When I searched within my own self, I found I was the worst of all. I am, O Kabir, the worst of all. Except for me, all are good. He who understands this is indeed my friend." The principal aim of saints is to tell us that we should try to get rid of our pride and ego. They guide us to be humble and to devote ourselves to meditation on the Supreme Lord. Then alone will we fulfill the object of human life. Dadu Sahib says, "With what face can I laugh and speak? O Dadu, I should rather weep. I am departing and I have wasted this priceless birth of mine for nothing." Mahatma Charandas says, "Horses and elephants and wealth and countless concubines, each one as lovely as the moon, all these are worthless, for without the treasure of the name, one suffers endless tortures in the land of Yama, the Lord of Death." Guru Nanak says, "There is no true companion, no true comrade other than Naam. Salvation can be gained only if you meditate on Naam." When humility is born within us, we will naturally turn towards God. This, however, can happen only when we have the company of saints, and it is only through the infinite grace of the Lord that we can get the company of the saints, His saviors. The grace of the Lord. We can never truly worship unless the Lord wills it. How can a blind man ever catch hold of a man who can see, unless the latter either calls out to him or gives him his own hand? Our attention is always concentrated on the world and its passing show. We are entirely world-oriented. Only the Lord's mercy and grace can make us God-oriented. Guru Amar Das says, "Birth and death are in your hands, O Lord. It is only he on whom your grace is showered who is exalted." Similarly, Kabir Sahib says, "The Lord can do all, man can do nothing. He can turn a mustard seed into a mountain, for the mountain is contained within the seed. The individual neither did nor can he do anything. This body is not capable of achieving aught. Whatever has been done by the Lord. And that is how Kabir became Kabir the Great One. Neither did he nor can he do anything. He is capable of doing naught. Whatever has been done was done by you. I have done nothing. How can I say I have done it? You were the one within me. In the same way, Christ says in the Bible that a man is by himself powerless to realize God. He can only do so with his grace. Therefore said I unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him of my Father. Guru Arjan at the beginning of the poem called the 12 months says, We have been separated from you because of our karmas. Be gracious now and unite us with yourself, O Lord. O Lord, he says, we are separated from you because of our karmas, and it is not in our power to return to you. Therefore, in your kindness, shower your grace and mercy on us, so that we may return to you. Further, he says, if the choice were our own and anyone could meet the beloved, why would we be weeping and suffering in separation? The Lord is obtained in the company of saints. O Nanak, enjoy that bliss. If we could reach you by our own efforts, he says to God, why should we be undergoing the misery of birth and rebirth and be crying our heart out in suffering? We are utterly helpless, unable to reach you by ourselves. Christ says that no one can come to him unless it is by the wish and will of the Lord. No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him. And he adds, I pray not for the world, but for them which thou hast given me, for they are thine. Guru Amar Das goes as far as saying this of the Lord, The counterfeit coin and the genuine, both, O Lord, have been made by you, and you yourself are the judge. The coins that are genuine, you put in your treasury. The base ones are rejected and left to wander, lost in delusion. The Lord created all human beings, both good and bad. He himself sits as judge to determine who is good and who is bad, who is genuine and who is counterfeit. Those whom he makes fit for his test, he accepts in his treasury, while the others continue to wander about in this world of delusion. When the Lord bestows his grace, he does so through the saints. Actually, he himself comes in the form of human being and awakens in us love for the Lord. By devotion to the name, he merges us in him. Guru Amar Das says, By his grace we find a true guru who teaches us the practice of attaching the soul to the Shabd. Christ says in the Bible, Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, and ordained you that ye should go and bring forth fruit. With the Lord's grace we obtain the company of saints. With their grace we learn the secret of joining our soul with the sound current, the word or the name. Once the mind becomes fond of listening to this voice of God, it turns away forever from the world and all worldly objects. The sweetness of this inner spiritual melody makes everything else seem tasteless or bitter. Compared with its enchantment, everything else seems dull and uninteresting. The possession of diamonds naturally causes one to lose interest in colored shells. In the same way, the sweetness of the inner melody makes this world lose its attraction and turns the mind Godwards. One's love for the world comes to an end and love for the God takes its place. Guru Amar Das says, Whatever is by his will. By his will we find the Guru who fills our mind with love for Shabd. Similarly, John the Baptist says, A man can receive nothing except it be given him from heaven. Whenever the Lord wishes us to join him, he connects our soul with the word or audible life stream through one of the saints. Saints are messengers of God. They come to the world at his command. They take back to their real home those who are blessed with his grace. Christ speaks of this in the Bible saying, And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. I in them and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me and hast loved them as thou hast loved me. The message of saints. Every saint brings from the house of the Lord only one message. Every saint comes to preach the same truth, the same reality, the same spirituality. They say there is one God and that our soul is of his essence. We can escape from the wheel of death and rebirth only when we merge in the Lord. The Lord dwells in the temple of the human body. It is only in the human form that we can realize Him. The obstacle between us and the Lord is our mind. It is because of our mind that we do not see God within ourselves. This obstacle can be removed only by means of joining our soul with the divine melody. Both the sound current and the Lord are within us. The way to Him is also in the human body. It is only by being in the company of the saints that we can know the path within and succeed in bringing the soul in touch with the transcendent music. In the Bible, this Shabd is called the Word or Logos. Christ also calls it living water. He says, "But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life." Guru Nanak calls the word or the name elixir or nectar, and Muslim saints call it the water of life. For by getting it, we gain life eternal and free the soul from the prison of the body. The company of the saints can be had only through the grace of the Lord. No saint comes to the world with a new teaching or philosophy. He brings the same ancient wisdom. But after the departure of the saints, we forget their teaching. We forget the reality. Then another saint makes his appearance, tells us of the eternal reality, and frees us from our doubts and delusions. Thus lives on the eternal message, the call of God. This is the natural way designed by God for people to meet Him. Saints come to remind us of this true path. Christ says in the Bible, "For I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me. He gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. My doctrine is not mine, but His that sent me." Every saint speaks from experience and not from hearsay. Whatever he witnesses himself, that alone he speaks of. Guru Arjan says, "Hearken to what the saints say. It is the truth, nothing but the truth, for they speak only of what they have seen with their own eyes." Dadu Sahib says, "With his own eyes has Dadu seen what he is speaking of. As for others, the words they utter are only hearsay." Similarly, Tulsi Sahib says, "Tulsi has seen with his own inner eye, and as he has seen, so has he described." And Christ says, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, we speak that we do know, and testify that we have seen."
End of The Path by Maharaj Charan Singh, published by Radha Swami Satsang Bias, print copyright 1969-2002. An audio recording copyright 2021. Radha Swami Satsang Bias. All rights reserved.